Okay, it is close to the appointed hour, so we will call to order the House Interim Committee on Healthcare. We're joined today by, or will be joined shortly by the Senate Committee for these proceedings, and I'm told they will be coming forthwith. We'll start off with the adoption of committee rules.
Mr. Chair.
Organizational meeting.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated 9/21/11.
Co-Chair Greenlick has moved to adopt the committee rules dated 9/21/11. Is there any discussion? Can we vote on that? Okay. Let's do a roll call on this one. Any discussion? Did I miss anybody? Okay. Moving forward. Please call the roll.
Representative Doherty.
Yes.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Coyle.
Aye.
Representative Wagner.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Kenmer.
Aye.
Co-Chair Thompson.
Aye.
Co-Chair Greenlight.
Aye.
Okay.
The ayes have it. The committee rules are adopted as distributed.
I'd like to call the Senate Interim Committee on Health Care, Human Services, and Rural Health Policy to order. Welcome, everybody. I missed you, but I had a good summer. Hope you did, too.
The Republicans.
I would like to open an organizational meeting and would like the committee to consider adoption of the committee rules. Senator Shields.
Adoption of the committee rules dated 9/22/2001. 2011.
Is there any discussion?
He does.
Is there any opposition? So ordered.
Would you like to do introductions, right?
Okay, now? let's do introductions.
I'm Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland.
I'm Al Bates, Southern Oregon. I'm a little worried about my Republican colleagues on this committee. I don't know what happened to them.
I heard Senator Morris isn't coming through, is that right?
I think maybe Senator Morris is out of the country.
Is he?
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I think he's in
Canada.
Okay.
Haven't heard? Yeah.
And I'm Lori Monis Anderson. I represent Gresham Trout Delwood Village in Fairview. And
Jim Thompson. I represent District 23, which is rural West Willamette Valley with a section south of Salem.
I'm Mitch Greenlick. I represent House District 33, which is Northwest Portland, out to North Plains. Soon to get skinnier. Not me, my district.
Well, me too, actually.
Yeah,
me too.
Right,
yeah. Ah, that new PEP program's working.
It is.
I don't know for me. I'm Bill Kenmer, District 39, Oregon City, Canby area, soon to include parts of Clackamas, Damascus, Carver, Boring, and Estacada.
Val Hoyle, represent House District 14, West Eugene, Junction City, Cheshire, and Albador, soon to not include Albador, but all the rest.
Cheshire.
Representative Jim Widener, used to be primarily Yamhill County and a little bit of Polk County. Now I'm Yamhill County, Washington County, and do not have a large portion of the rural Yamhill County and go into Hillsborough now, so in Hillsborough High to go with McMinnville.
I'm Margaret Doherty. I'm House District 35, which is Tigard, King City, in Southwest Portland.
I'm Julie Parrish, House District 37, Westland, Tualatin, Stafford, and a little nibble at King City. Still.
Great. Well, I'd like to go right into informational meeting, if that's all right. We're going to have an update on Oregon Health System Transformation, House Bill 3650, which I am extremely excited about. And are we going to get somebody on the phone?
Yes.
Okay. So Bruce Goldberg and Mike Bonetto and Eric Parsons and Lillian Shirley. And then on the phone, Sandy, who do we have on the phone? Or we'll get
Chuck Hoffman.
Dr. Chuck Hoffman. Great. And while we're doing that, Senator Cruz can introduce himself.
To who?
To everybody.
Oh, hi.
Senator Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1, relatively new to these issues. So,
catch up. Hi, this is Dr. Hoffman. I'm sorry, but I can't come to the phone right now. And I'll get back to you as soon as I can. Thanks. Bye.
We'll try in a minute.
So much for that.
We'll get started.
Yes, go ahead.
Co-chairs Thompson Greenlick, Chair Mona Sanderson, for the record, Bruce Goldberg, the director of the Oregon Health Authority, here today with our Health Policy Board Chair and Vice Chair, who are primarily the ones you're going to hear from. We have been doing a lot of work over the last couple of months implementing House Bill 3650, putting together a variety of work plans to bring to the legislature in February, and we're here today to report on that. We also have for everybody, those who like things in paper, we have binders with all of the materials that we've been working off of, and for those electronically who are paperless, we're going to get them to you in a paperless form. And with that, I'd like to turn things over to Eric Parsons, Chair of the Health Policy Board.
Good morning. Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlick, and Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. For the record, I am Eric Parsons. I'm Chair of the Oregon Health Policy Board. I'm from Portland. In a previous life, I am now retired. In a previous life, I was the president of Standard Insurance Company, and I have been interested in health issues for a long time. I've been watching for many years as the steps toward health delivery system transformation have progressed. And I'm very pleased with where we are today. I'd like to start by simply reviewing just a little bit of where we've been. As you all well know, earlier this year, the legislature approved a framework for the transformation of the healthcare delivery system in Oregon. And I want to start by simply saying thank you. The framework that you approved paralleled very closely the plan that was developed by the Oregon Health Policy Board over a period of what's been 18 months now. It was about 12 months at that time. A lot of work was done by the Health Policy Board members. It was based on work that had been done previously by the Health Fund Board and many others. And so it is a logical next step in the work toward healthcare transformation that we all seek. I'd like to acknowledge that the legislature set very clear expectations about what was expected next in terms of activities. The Health Policy Board has read the legislation carefully, has heard your requests, and it's very clear that there are some specific elements that need to come forward at the next step, and we're working very hard to accomplish that for you. We're taking the work very seriously. The deliverables that we'll talk about in just a minute are the primary topic at each of our health policy board meetings, and I'd like to also point out that most of the members of the Oregon Health Policy Board are serving on working groups appointed by the governor as well. And so this is a significant body of work. It is one we're taking very seriously. We hope to be back here again soon, and in February with a very viable proposal for your consideration. With that, I'd like to go to the slides. Start with the one that at the top says Oregon Health Policy Board Products. I mentioned that we heard clearly what it is you're looking for, and that's what we're working on. By the time the legislature convenes in February, we intend to have brought to you draft legislative language for the implementation of coordinated care organizations. We intend to deliver a business plan for CCO development. We understand that the details of that business plan are very important to the success of the transformation that we envision. They're very important to you as you consider whether this can work.
Dr. Hoffman?
Yes.
This is Sandy. We have you on speakerphone at the Joint Senate Healthcare and House Healthcare Committee, so you are live. Mr. Parsons is just finishing up his introduction, so you can listen in, and they'll invite you to start speaking when it's appropriate.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Good morning, Dr. Hoffman.
Good morning, everyone.
In addition, we will deliver to you strategies for cost containment with a focus on medical liability, and we will deliver proposed standards for specified healthcare workers, community health workers, peer wellness specialists, and personal health navigators, all very important components to the success of the transformation that we envision. The next slide, elements of a business plan, gets down to the details that we know that you're going to be very interested in. HB 3650 was very clear in directing Oregon Health Authority and Oregon Health Policy Board to address specific issues. These elements will be included, and they're listed here. I'll go through them very quickly. Obviously, the qualification process and criteria for a coordinated care organization will be very important in defining exactly what that organization is, what it will do. A global budget methodology, very important. How are we going to allocate the resources to get the outcomes that we seek? Savings models and financial reporting requirements. We need to know if the system is working, how well it's working, and for whom it's working. Health equity and health disparity strategies, something that's very important, something that's come up in virtually every one of our work groups, particularly the CCO criteria group, and something that's getting a lot of attention. The legislation specifically calls for plans for contracting with PEB and OEB and other public health benefit purchasers in the future, and we'll address that. Metrics, very important again in knowing whether we're succeeding. Outcomes, quality, and efficiency metrics will all be included. Coordination of care is a foundation upon which we expect this transformation to occur, particularly focused on those who are dually eligible for Medicare and Medicaid, a significant source of expense for the system, a significant group needing high-quality care. Finally, the transition is something that we recognize will be very important, and we're going to make sure that we have transition plans in this business plan. The other thing that you've requested and which we will address is a method for alternative dispute resolution. In terms of process, I'd like to give you just a quick update, and then I'll turn it over to others. Because this is such important and complicated work, we've developed a process that we think will bring the best thinking to the problem. Four work groups have been appointed by the governor. They deal with CCO criteria, the global budget, outcomes and metrics, and the specific integration of Medicare and Medicaid dual eligibles. We had 400 well-qualified people apply to participate in these work groups, and we're very pleased by the support that we saw. 133 of these individuals were ultimately appointed to one of these groups. They represent a wide diversity of interests, opinions, and we are truly seeking as much and as broad an input base as we possibly can. Each of the four groups meets monthly. Reports on those. We have members of our health policy board attending those meetings and working with the groups. Reports of their work come to our board along with public comments that are actively sought during the course of each month. The board works to synthesize the income, synthesize, I'll get it eventually, the work of those four groups so that we have a cohesive whole, and then we report back to them so that they can be working along a common pathway. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Lillian Shirley, who is the Vice Chair of the Oregon Health Policy Board. I'll let her further introduce herself. Lillian?
Thanks, Eric. I am Lillian Shirley. I'm Vice Chair of the Policy Board. I'm also serving as the Director of the Multnomah County Health Department. As Eric said, we have been very specific. We've learned from the other processes that we went through to get the House bill together and are trying to have some improvements on our process. And this feedback loop that we've put in, as Eric said, we will be hearing not at just at the end of the work group sessions, but every month they are coming before us, and we're having a discussion among the board of where they are. And an example is last night and the night before, is as the global budget and the CCO met, we were able to feedback what we heard and what the board's discussion was, and again, kind of identify some gaps that we might have heard and some further thinking that we wanted to hear from the work groups that are informing this important work. So first, I'd like to just go over with you where we are with the CCO criteria group. I'll be talking about two of the groups and then turning them over to Dr. Hoffman to talk about some of the work that he's been sitting in on the other two groups. So the CCO criteria group came together and at their first meeting really decided that they had to prioritize some of the key things that needed to be in place before we went forward with establishing CCOs. And and those priorities were real concrete ability to understand how we will achieve in Oregon health equity among all of our residents. And then patient rights and responsibilities, and then the CCO financial reporting, what the risk models will be, and the business plans, the outlines for how the business plans need to be documented, how they need to show that they have the capacity to be able to deliver for people that would be in their CCO. And then also extremely important, CCO governance. The language in the bill is very specific, and people are discussing about what that would mean, what that might mean in different parts of the state. The groups also identified other really important considerations that they want to grapple with, which includes access, care management, the integration of the long-term care population, innovation, how do we foster innovation in different parts of the state, that balance between being really prescriptive and having accountability, but also allowing for innovation, how we're going to use health information technology, what it really means to have a patient-centered primary care home and how you document that and how we can measure that, what kind of collaboration, and also extremely important, what are our consumer engagement strategies? Are we really using kind of best practices to make sure the consumers not only have we ask them what they think, but they have a real voice in how this is going to be set up and how it's going as we roll out these transformation changes.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, may I ask a question? Lillian, one thing that comes to mind is these are all obviously critical elements. Is there an effort to portray what a CCO is, other than dealing with the individual questions? I mean, is that clear?
Representative, I think you'd find in the discussions, yes. That's kind of the macro discussion people are engaging in. What's included, what's excluded, how will this be, what will the governance body be, what kind of a creation will it be, how will we relate to it, and what does it really mean? And that's definitely, we're trying to make sure that not, you know, before we get into the details, we have that robust discussion, I would say, from the meeting that I was at, the robust discussion from very different sectors in our community who are serving on this panel, because it means different things to different people right now. So we're trying to slog through that to come to an understanding of what we mean.
Fine, fellow. Just, yeah, I think somewhere we've all worked with this issue. Somewhere we need a snapshot of what that animal looks like. I mean, you get into what its blood work is, what its physiology is, how fast it runs, but the question is, what does the thing look like? It would be very helpful if you sort of coalesce around something that can be shared with others about this is what we're talking about.
Yeah. Excellent point.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, and we can definitely work on presenting that. Thank you.
And just to follow up on that, who initially is this going to affect? I know we know the Oregon Health Plan people are the ones, but when I'm talking in broader scope, they say, well, what about PEB? I heard about PEB. Well, what about OWEB? I heard about OWEB. So I think that at least initially in February, we'll want to know exactly what the committee is going to recommend.
Thank you. Yes. People are very sensitive to that question. Representative Thompson.
Are we able, in this discussion of CCOs, to keep the description broad enough that we can allow for different kinds of organizations to be CCOs depending on how it evolves locally? I'm a little concerned that this thing may run to a point where we're going to simply say a CCO consists of these people. They all come together around the table on Thursday, and this is the way it is statewide. What I'm hearing, talking to groups, rural groups around mm-hmm. this, the state, is that they're very concerned that their community interests will be left out in favor of a state interest or a bureaucratic interest. And a lot of these groups want to build something locally. And will that, do you feel we're keeping things broad enough we can do that?
Absolutely. You know, Representative Thompson, we have stated over and over again, because I think when you get into the weeds, people start thinking about, I think as Representative Greenlake said, you know, what's the physiology, you know, what's, we're trying to say that we really need to come together around what are the principles and outline the principles, not be prescriptive about, you know, like a checkoff list of what exact, you know, what capacities and or what organizations need to be in, but more what are the principles and how can a community identify to achieve those principles, what are they going to bring in to their concept of a CCO. And I think that that's one of the keys that's going to be for success, because as Senator Mona Anderson pointed out, you know, we're not trying to do that, we're doing this initially for the Medicaid population, but your vision, the vision of the legislature, was much broader than that. So we have to make sure that the principles allow for really Oregon's transformation.
Right.
To achieve this triple aim and not just managing one subset of our population. So I would say we start every meeting reminding people about that. Absolutely.
Okay, good. Yeah.
If I can add just one more word on that, I think that all of us on the Health Policy Board and I'm sure all of you recognize that we're about to take a relatively significant leap here, and if we're to be successful, this thing has to work. We understand that, and we believe, and I believe the members of the Health Policy Board believe, that it will work differently in different parts of the state and that we need to set it up so that it can.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Chair Moss Anderson. I'm going to kind of do the same question, but maybe from a different angle. I'm very concerned about the local ownership and the local buy-in for what you're doing. So as you go through these meetings, what are you doing to ensure that we continue to focus on the local governance and the local buy-in for CCOs?
Well, I think, you know, I can't tell you what the answer is to that yet because we haven't gotten to that point. But I know that just, and as a check on what I'm going to say to you, Representative Freeman, if you look at even the minutes of the Oregon Health Policy Board discussion that we had at our last meeting Tuesday a week ago, very much that was questions that people had. We don't want to have kind of a one-size-fits-all prescriptive. We want to have principles, and we want to make sure, because each community is different, and we know, I mean, I come from the public health perspective, we know that those solutions to health will happen because of community input and community, not just, you know, not as a cliche, local conditions, but really what does the local community buy into to help be a partner with the healthcare industry and the healthcare system and the state, you know, around what is it that will make them buy into achieving this as a partner for us for better health, and not just, you know, not just a list of services that we think they may want, but really make that a community partnership. And that's part of, I think, the uniqueness of our transformation here in Oregon. I know, Eric, you might want to weigh in.
Well, one more thought, and that simply is that that as a part of our process, we are doing a very broad outreach throughout the state, looking for input from a wide range of communities and types of communities. And the other thing I'll point out is that you're looking at a couple people here from the metropolitan area, but on the phone we have Dr. Hoffman from Baker City. And Chuck, not to put you on the spot, but if you have anything to add on this topic, we'd be certainly willing to hear that.
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
So, speaking specifically to this question, I met with the county commission chair 2 days ago.
Could you introduce yourself for the record?
I'm sorry. For the record, I'm Charles Hoffman. I'm a primary care physician in Baker City, Oregon, a member of the Health Policy Board.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, I met with the county commission chair 2 days ago, and he shared the exact same apprehension that you're talking about. Of course, the county is responsible for the public health as well as the mental health care in Baker County and the region. And his question to me was, what should he be doing? Should he be calling community leaders together? Should he be calling the mental health managed care organization together? Should he be getting the hospital together? You know, he's concerned that a large hospital organization will become the CCO and the county will frankly suffer from it because they won't be able to have the input. I tried to assure him that that will not be the case. it's a little bit difficult to reassure people at this point because we don't really have a good idea of what these CCOs will look like. Now, I think we all believe that in many regions of the states, CCOs are going to look a lot like MCOs. They're going to have the infrastructure that allows them to integrate addictions and mental health, as well as dual eligible care, into their managed care organizations. But those organizations don't exist everywhere. And what I told Chair Warner was, you know, look, the governor made sure to put county representatives on every one of these work groups. I think the Association of Oregon Counties needs to be having regular updates from the people who are serving on the work on those work groups, and to stay actively involved in this process as we listen to people and we develop these criteria. We frankly, it's clear that we have to have criteria for the CCOs. I mean, you can't be a CCO just because you want to. You have to meet certain criteria, and you're going to have to meet certain performance goals. But as we develop those criteria, you know, the legislature, you folks, made it clear to the Health Policy Board that we are supposed to make this an open public process, and we're supposed to listen to what we hear back. And I can assure you, to a member, as well as staff, we are doing that and will continue to do it.
Thank you. Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Transition's interesting. I'm sitting here next to Doc Bates, who's got a computer. That's transition. Have you figured
it
out yet?
I don't know how to use it. That's okay. Another transition, okay. See?
And that's an inside thing from all of our committee meetings during session when Bates and Morris were struggling with their computers and those of us with paper were doing fine. But, I guess, Madam Chair, my comfort level in this is if you look at what the Health Policy Board is doing, what they're doing is bringing something to us. And it takes legislative approval for anything to happen. Now, for example, Representative Freeman and I are intimately familiar with what's going on in Douglas County, and they're doing some very innovative work there. Doc Bates, you know what's going on in Jackson County. You know, I think with the scope of this committee, because we do cover the state, we will make sure that the innovative work that's happening is not going to be derailed by something we do. So I think it's going to be incumbent upon us to be deep in the weeds between now and February as all of these work groups move forward. But the beauty of 3650 was it all comes back to us, and it's our decision at the end of the day.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Bates.
Thanks. I'm pretty deeply involved in this, you might well guess, and trying to sort of stay in the sidelines and watch what's going on. I enjoyed the meeting last night. It's the first transformation meeting group I had a chance to go to. Saw some things there that were very reassuring and a few things that were concerning to me. I think the biggest concern I have right now, and you may want to address this as you go along, is timelines. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to make a transformation here very quickly. Right. And the conversations I'm seeing at transformation in other areas of the state are pretty broad yet. Getting the guidelines together, getting what this is going to look like, and getting your principle together are very important. A lot of those discussions occurred during the last session. A lot of discussions seem to be being repeated themselves in these meetings. I'm still concerned last night, for instance, that I didn't hear much about what this thing really looks like. Are we talking about MCOs, which I think we are, frankly. I think it's the reality. And how they have to transform themselves to do this, not MCOs on steroids necessarily, MCOs that have changed dramatically what they do and somehow integrating with their county partners, behavioral health, and drug and alcohol treatment. That's going to be a real tough thing to do, but it can be done. And it's going to vary from community to community. What I did hear last night very clearly was this is going to be community-driven. I was very glad to hear that. That was absolutely crystal clear for each of the groups that were reporting back. The governance issues were still kind of up in the air a little bit about who's responsible in the CCO for making CCO work, whether it was advisory group, whether it was community members, or whether it was the people who were actually responsible financially for it. And I think that has to be worked out yet. Frankly, I think it should be financial, but that's where we're going. The other groups I didn't hear about last night very much were provider groups. I didn't hear much discussion about physicians, nurse practitioners, behavioral people, drug and alcohol people. The providers just weren't, some of them were there, but they didn't seem to be speaking up. They're very broad discussions yet. I think they have to come forward and speak up more. So good luck. I think you're doing the right stuff. But I think there's time to you have to put some reality to this thing. And the reality, I believe, is going to be, and you can say something different, absolutely, correct me, is going to be taking these 16 MCOs we've got and having them dramatically change what they're doing. But they're going to have to be the basis of this thing. I don't see any other group that can do this right now. And if you can suggest somebody else can do it, let me know. When I say MCOs, we're talking about situations like Good Sam, where we have a hospital-based MCO, or 12th in the hospital-based MCO. Some MCOs stand alone, some that don't. And I didn't hear a big discussion last night also about the Tri-County area, which I think is going to be the biggest challenge. Roseburg's jumping up. Medford is slowly getting off on his feet. The coast is coming along. I think Ben's going to make it. They're going to be out there for us. The Tri-County area is going to be tough. And I didn't hear much discussion about that either. So lots of challenges. Thank you for doing all this, and we'll stay with you on it.
I think we'd like to find some way to disagree with almost any of that, but I don't think we do. It's a big challenge. Thank you for your support.
Representative Kennever?
My central point just got made. I think the urban are the challenge areas.
Yeah.
I just, you know, in urban, I just mm-hmm. was bumped about Lane County, too. But, I mean, I think some of these others where there are smaller networks and smaller numbers of providers, it's easier to do. But how do you start splitting up and dividing and work and getting people who are historically competitive in the urban areas to buy into a model and work cooperatively? I think that's... And the other issue is timing. We're sure short on time to do this.
Okay,
proceed.
If I may make one quick response to that, we agree that the issues in the urban area are different and very significant and very complex. We have had a fair bit of input from some of the urban systems. We are aware that they are having discussions about how they may form their attitudes about how this can work, and we have some optimism that it may come together. Greg Van Pelt from Providence in particular has been active in a lot of this work and is galvanizing some of the other providers in the metropolitan area. So there is some progress being made. We have to see it to a conclusion.
And just one comment I'll add on that. Those discussions are also kind of linked into our discussions. I mean, there's a lot of these. We're providing you today with kind of a feedback on the official process, but that there's a tremendous amount of dialogue going on, even around the issues of health information technology, for instance. You know, people are coming in smaller groups saying, what do we need, and how do we feed that into the official groups that are looking at health information technology? In the same way, a number of people have been included in all of these discussions that are going on in the urban areas with the large systems, because most of them in the urban area like Providence and Legacy really span boundaries, and the whole issue of cross state boundaries is even also there because of the work that some of these systems do in Southwest Washington. So, you know, there's so much going on, but I think that the real positive, the positive thing that's happened in answer to some of your questions, Senator Bates, is people are really talking to each other. You know, in a much more robust way than even, I think, when we were all involved in subcommittees of the Health Fund Board. You know, there's been a real shift, I think. Not that it won't be hard, not that we won't get everything done, we know that, but can we kind of go for as much as possible to get work out? Yeah. So,
Senator?
Yes.
And I know you got a big presentation. I'll try to be brief. So it sounds like there's a lot going on, and you got these work groups working, and at some point we're expecting some kind of a deliverable, some sort of an outcome. What does that look like, and what's the time frame where the legislature will see something?
If you don't mind, we'll get to that just about three or four slides from now, and I'll try to talk that through and save some time for further questions.
Thank you.
So just to go back to the work group reports, the global budget methodology group, great discussion around that, very broad representation. Their main deliverable is the criteria for including services in funding for global budgets and what's in and what's out. The group has discussed their highest priority topics, and they agreed that they really need to focus very concretely on program inclusion, exclusion considerations, not necessarily deciding for every area what that would look like, but what are the considerations, risk sharing between the state and the CCOs, and risk adjustment, and assuring sustainability, and the Medicare integration. I'm going to turn it over now to Dr. Hoffman to discuss the other two groups which he's participated in. So, Chuck, are you there? Dr. Hoffman?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Chuck, ready? I'm doing the handoff now.
Are we ready to roll on?
Ready to roll on. Outcomes, quality, and efficiency.
Okay. Again, for the record, I'm Chuck Hoffman from Baker City. And I want to talk a little bit about the metrics committee first. The job of this work group is not to select the actual criteria that CCOs are going to be evaluated on, but rather to identify what we refer to as the domains of that evaluation process and the principles that we should expect the CCOs to select their performance indicators based on. Now, the domains concept is a little confusing, but basically, those were your instructions to us in 3650. In addition to the domains that you prescribed to us, the work group has added three additional ones, and those are prevention, end-of-life care, and accountability for system transformation. Within those domains, the group has identified nine general categories of principles, and I'm going to give you an example of one of those nine so you can kind of get a feeling of the process we're going for. This particular principle is consistency with existing state and national quality measures with room for innovation when needed. So that's basically one of the principles that a CCO should use to adopt their evaluation criteria. Now, within that principle, we've developed, with the work group, selection criteria. And here's a couple of the selection criteria: that the measure is nationally validated, that the measure is a required reporting element in other health quality or purchasing initiatives, and that national or other benchmarks exist for performance on the measure. Within that concept, we realize that once a CCO adopts criteria, that criteria itself is going to need to be revised and evaluated. And so we actually have revision criteria as well. And for example, two criteria for revision of this principle include that the measure loses national endorsement, or that the measure is unique to Oregon, and other standards could be used. Now, within that context, I think it's important that you understand that the work group feels very strongly, and the policy board agrees with them, that these criteria are really going to fall into three general categories. The first is a set of core criteria that everyone feels are most important and measurable and can be compared across CCOs. That said, as we've been speaking about the community power of CCOs, we also recognize that there are going to be CCO-specific criteria they're going to be selected for their relevance to the population that particular CCO serves. So I guess what I'm saying is you're going to have some criteria across CCOs that can be measured, but within a population, there are also criteria that's going to be important to that. The third category speaks back to this transformation innovation that everybody's interested in and everybody wants to drive. And so we anticipate that some criteria, frankly, will be test criteria or specifically innovative criteria that, may be valuable, may not, but it's going to allow the CCO to at least move into that realm and dabble in those sort of issues. So that's where we are with metrics. The next meeting is Monday. I think this group is making great progress. And unless there's any questions, I'll move on to the Medicare, Medicaid integration.
I'd like to just say something really quickly. This is Senator Mona Sanderson. I happen to spend a lot of time on the computer, so I had to go to my ophthalmologist because I need my prescription changed. I was talking to him, and of course we start talking about what we've done in healthcare, and he's pointed out a number of things that has helped him. But he was citing an Oregon health plan person that he has that actually lives in Tillamook, and his practice is in Gresham. Actually, I think it's just on the border of Troutdale. And he was saying, what does the Oregon health plan pay for her transportation from Tillamook to Gresham to have her eyes checked? And I said, well, I think that has to do with the federal government and waivers, and that a patient can go to anyone they choose. And I said, I'm not sure about this, but I wanted to make sure that transportation is part of hopefully what the CCOs will take on as a metrics and see how they can bend that cost curve on transportation. Is that... Are you getting down to that type of detail?
Thank you, Senator. At this point, in all honesty, absolutely not. We're still, we were at 60,000 feet in September. We're going to come down, or August, we're going to come down to about 30,000 feet. But see, that I think the way we're looking at things is that's one, that could be one of the criteria that you could look across CCOs. You can measure across CCOs. Out here, I run into the same sort of situation, only it's not just from one Oregon county to another Oregon county. I run into that situation where it's one state to another state because our referral area is Boise. And so, how do we make sure that people get the specialty care that they need without having to drive past the specialist in Ontario, the specialist in Nampa to get to Boise? So your
points
well taken.
Thank you. Real quick, I just have one question on, and you may be coming to it, but what are we doing to drive the patient to make them go where we need them to go? Because right now we're saying all the stuff that we want to do and how we want to take care of them, but there needs to be responsibility on the patient's half, and that's the problem with the Oregon Health Plan now is there's nothing to drive the patient to go to a doctor, and they don't pay a dime to go to an emergency room, so they go to the emergency room because it's hard to get into a doctor. What are we doing to address this problem via co-pays for the Oregon Health Plan or something like that? Because that's really the only way you'd be able to steer the patient. I'm just kind of curious if you're looking at those type of issues.
Yes, we are, and that's an excellent segue into the next section of if there are other questions on the criteria, we can answer those, and then I'll move on.
Senator Bates.
Hi, Chuck. Al Bates here.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Good to hear your voice. Chuck, when you talked about metrics, did you have a discussion about who would be collecting the metrics? Would it be self-reporting by the CCOs, or would the state be collecting that data? And I'm talking about the core issues here. I'm a little concerned about self-reporting. I'd rather see it at the state level just for the core issues, not only from the point of view of getting some numbers that are probably a little more real and we can compare, but also, as you know, there's a huge variation in healthcare and how certain disease groups are treated from area to area. and some of those differences are quite expensive and not based on good outcomes. Has there been a discussion about that?
Well, Senator, a little bit, and I'll just give you my own perspective on that. You know, in the midst of getting all this work together, everybody is stretched pretty thin, and I have a lot of concern about the health authority's ability to do all the investigation for each CCO. I think another route to go would be to develop these specific criteria that are pretty well locked, and it would be very hard to fudge. I mean, I agree with you that you can report diabetes many different ways, but if we have specific across CCO criteria that each CCO knows how it's to be measured, I think we can get there without the state having to go to every CCO and look through the books, so to speak. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And the issue I'm trying to get to is a huge variation in treatment. I mean, how you're treated for a disease is often more often a reflection of the geography, what particular physicians or providers are there, than what the best outcomes are. And that's one of the issues we've been trying to get to in this state and across the nation for 20 years. And I know you're well aware of it, Chuck. This is one way of getting to that. The variation is huge. It's not based on outcomes that we should be looking at. And if the cost to patients and to the state are huge also. I was wondering if that was part of the metrics you're looking at.
Yes, I think I can honestly say that it is, because we realize that the type of care is a lot different. For example, in Baker, I am the diabetes specialist. In the metropolitan area, I would be not the diabetes specialist. But if you develop the right criteria, you can compare the results of my patients with those in a metropolitan area.
Thank you.
Senator Bates, one more comment, if I may, and that is simply that House Bill 2009 directed the Health Policy Board to pursue the development of an all-payer, all-claims database. That work is underway and will provide a fair amount of information against which we can cross-reference.
Good reminder. Thank you. That's true.
Okay, let's continue. Okay, and there's two more people, and I'm looking at the timeline, so let's have Representative Widener and Senator Shields, but we've got...
Relatively quick, since Senator Bates kind of prompted it, and Chuck. Real quickly, because we're looking at seeing what's going on, I'm wondering, is there anybody looking into, take for example, McDonald's or JCPenney's, they have a point-of-sale system. They can tell you how many underwear out of one department have been sold up to the minute. Why are we not looking into something like that? We're spending $54 million on an exchange when, to me, this would be more important. We can tell how many people are being seen for diabetes that day, how many people have been seen for influenza across the whole system. That way, if you have a viral outbreak or anything like that, you can see it with everybody very, very quickly. And to me, that should be a direction we're going in. I don't know. Are you guys looking into doing that?
Yes. And I'm not sure who asked that question, but that would fall into the innovative or test criteria. So CCOs would be free, and we would encourage them to adopt those kind of criteria. And we do that for exactly the reasons that you just mentioned.
But if I may follow up, to me that's something that the state would have to be in place, and then they would just buy a terminal so the state could monitor what's happening with the state dollars across the system. If they each put in their own system, then we don't have any control, or we can't see what's happening at that level unless we get access to their system.
A fair point, and we obviously will incorporate that point.
Senator Shields.
Last time I got briefed about the all claims, all payers database, I think what I heard is it was going to be ready in October, which is about 8 days away. Can you give me some type of timeline when that can be rolled out?
Senator Shields, right now I believe we are in the process of loading and cleaning the data. and I will get back to you on the exact day that we will be able to use the data. It's being loaded right now. I believe it's sometime
for
between...
For the record, could you introduce yourself?
For the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Oregon Health Authority, that at between now and I believe January 1, it will be able to actually mine the data out of it. I'll get you an exact date as to when it'll be sort of operational.
Thank you very much. Okay. Dr. Hoffman,
yes.
Could you continue?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so moving on to the Medicaid-Medicare integration work group, the job of this group is to identify strategies for improving the integration of acute care and long-term care for dual eligibles. And as you know, those are the patients who qualify for Medicaid and Medicare. Now, as tough as all of these work groups' responsibilities are, my personal perspective is this might be the toughest job of all. And the reason I say that is, frankly, these are our most vulnerable patients. And consequently, their healthcare costs are some of the highest. So the question of this work group comes down to, how do we coordinate the care of these individuals to improve their quality of care while at the same time we lower costs? That's a pretty tough nut to crack. And I want to just give you one anecdote of where I think this work group's going to end up. And this anecdote is a true story. It relates to one of my patients. We'll call her Mrs. L. She's 85 years old and lives in the nursing home here in Baker. She has Parkinson's disease and is quite debilitated. Last March, frankly, while I was at an Oregon Health Policy Board meeting, she got a bellyache. And the nursing home sent her to the emergency room. It was a Friday. She was evaluated by the emergency room physician. As you can imagine, she has an armload of medications. The emergency room physician, without any criticism of him or her at all, elected to admit the patient for observation to the on-call physician. Over the weekend, the patient received custodial care, and lo and behold, had a bowel movement. When I got back on Monday, her pain was gone, and I discharged her back to the nursing home. Now, her hospital bill was $25,000. In July, the exact same thing happened. Now, what we told the nursing home after that March event was, please contact us before you transfer one of our patients to the nursing home. They called us and told us that they wanted to send her to the emergency room. We said, no, wait. Now, we have adopted an open access scheduling process in our office. So when something like this comes up, we have someone who can go over. So one of my physician assistants went over, evaluated the patient, found her to not have any serious physical findings. We gave her a laxative. Her abdominal pain went away. And the total cost of that service was $112. So, you know, I guess my point in that story is there are savings and we can improve the quality. How we go about that is going to be a very difficult process. Because of the budgetary issues, you know, we're starting, in my opinion, with one of the toughest groups first. I'd much rather to start with this integration process with OEB and PEB because I think it would be easier. So we're kind of working it backwards, but that's what we have to do. The budget is what the budget is.
Thank you. Is that it on Medicaid integration that you're going to talk
about? That's all
about?
I have.
Okay. Yes, Senator Bates.
Chuck, Al Bates again. You're probably aware of this, but I want to make sure you get in your discussion on this integration program. Group Health in Seattle has put a program together doing exactly what you're talking about. Before, a patient in their group can be admitted to a hospital, even though they're at the emergency room, they have to be evaluated by either a nurse practitioner or a physician from that group to be admitted, and they take over responsibility of that from the ER doc. Now, that's not going to work as well in a small town like Baker, but the savings they've generated from that are absolutely huge. And it's the unnecessary hospitalizations that are really driving a lot of this, especially at the numbers you've talked about, which are common. I want to make sure everybody realizes a weekend admission to a hospital for $25,000 is the rule now, not the exception. Many of those admissions will be in the neighborhood of $30,000 to $35,000, depending what part of the state you're in. So that's not a knock on your hospital. But to cut those people off from being admitted unnecessarily for what is probably constipation, as an example, is really significant. The ER doctor is in the position that he's worried about being sued and his liability if he sends the patient back to the nursing home. He doesn't know the patient very well. They have a slew of problems. And the only people who can really make that decision on a rational basis is the treating physicians or nurse practitioners who are intimately involved with that patient. So, Chuck, I think your antidote is a good antidote and actually is a key to one of the ways of saving money. But we may have a larger discussion about setting up systems for all CCOs that say before admission to the hospital, you have to have somebody there in the emergency room evaluating that patient from the CCO, not just the ER doctor who is functioning like he or she are supposed to, but because of liability issues and other issues are always going to admit the patient.
I think you're right on the money. It was actually the group health experience that got us to implement this policy in our office. And I'll be honest with you, if I was a CCO, I guarantee you I would have a medical director in every long-term care facility, and I would pay them adequately to ensure that those patients receive the preventative and the long-term care coordination care that they needed.
All right, let's move on to timeline.
Okay, we'll do that. And with respect for your time, I will speak quickly about timeline. As we pretty well established earlier, there is a lot to do and a small amount of time in which to do it. Our intention is after we complete this update today, we'll, of course, go back to work. There's a lot yet to be accomplished. One of the things we're trying to do is keep the process as open as we can for as long as we can because the input we're receiving is very valuable. But working through November of 2011, we'll have a number of public input opportunities, a lot of information sharing. The four work groups appointed by the governor will continue to meet and do their work. We will have a statewide community input opportunity. In November, we will be back here to give you an update that will start to have a lot more specific information to it. In January of 2012, the products will be finalized by the deliverable products will be finalized by the Health Policy Board and delivered to the legislature. Your session, of course, is in February. Just as a reminder, because the question came up, those products that we'll deliver again include, but are not limited to, the legislative language that will allow for the implementation of CCOs and the business plan, which of course will include the description, the qualification process, criteria, global budget methodology, and many others. If the plan that we present is approved in the February legislative session, the next step will be to take it to CMS. We will require their help and cooperation to be able to fully implement the plans that we're working on. They are being kept up to date step by step, and they've been very supportive so far. And it's our hope that that by the late spring or summer of 2012, the first CCO will be in a position to launch.
So when?
In the late spring or summer of 2012.
Whoa.
Yeah.
In Douglas County?
Pardon me?
He's planning to get
we'd like to have several. Absolutely. Yeah, it could very well be. Absolutely.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Does that conclude your presentation?
That concludes my presentation.
Any other final questions? All right. Yes.
One clarification on how we're going to approach this. My understanding is if we do a bill, it's going to have to be submitted by December 5th. Not trying to compress the clock any here, but that's going to be a firm, fast rule.
We've been working and having discussions with legislators about the timing and format of getting that ledge concept in.
Okay. We won't miss the opportunity.
Senator Bates.
I think I'll direct this to Mike Bonetto, if I could. I'm worried about waivers from the federal government also. If we get something done and we get the bill out in February and you're trying to launch CCOs, as you should, not one, but multiple CCOs by the beginning of next fiscal year, I'm concerned about their need for waivers in certain areas. They can do a lot of stuff without waivers, but they're going to need some waivers. In your discussion with CMS, I know they've been very positive about helping us as much as they can, but the fastest I've ever seen a waiver is 6 months, maybe a year, year and a half. Any indication from them that they'll fast-track waivers for us?
Chair, member of the committee, for the record, Mike Vannetto, Governor's Office. Senator, I do. Dr. Goldberg was back in D.C. last week. The governor and I are going back to D.C. in a couple weeks, and that has been the main topic. I think from our early discussions, they are very, very interested in having us succeed, and they know our timeline. They've seen this, so they know they've really got kind of this 3 to 4 month window by the time, if legislation is approved, by the time we need to get CCOs up and running. And I defer to Bruce if he has any thoughts.
Briefly, Senator Bates, we're working in a parallel process so that they're aware of what we're putting together. If there's any showstoppers, anything that gives them great concern, they're letting us know so that coming out of February, when and if something is approved by the legislature, they should have a fairly good idea of what it is and then be able to turn around approvals fairly quickly.
And Representative Freeman.
I also wanted to kind of check in on one of the discussions was how we were going to be able to get some of these systems together. I just stepped out to actually talk to one of the big hospital systems. And one of the big concerns is the antitrust laws and them getting together and talking about how this is all going to work. When they start talking about dollars, it's illegal for them to do that. And I know that's one of the waivers we discussed. My question, I guess, is it seems like if we are going to get people around the table and start talking more specific, that waiver has to be in place. And to that extent, I would like to know what the timeline of that is.
Co-chairs, Representative Freeman, we're in the process of having those discussions with the federal government and hope to have those approvals in, along with the waiver request in the spring. But more specifically, in the interim, we've developed a process whereby we as the state can call together a number of parties under our auspices to begin to have some of those discussions. We've been doing that with providers in the Portland area, and it's been a successful way to begin to have those discussions and not be in violation of any laws.
It just seems to me as if there's any reason for people not to get on board with this, they're going to find it. So if long as you've got that worked out where we can have these groups get together and start solving this problem, I think that's helpful.
At the moment, we've got a good workaround.
Thank you, panel. I think we're going to move on. This is an extremely important area, and that's why I wasn't upset on letting you go longer, because I think this is one of the more complex issues that we really need to understand. Thank you, and I'd like to now move on to an update on the Oregon Health
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman.
Thank you all.
Okay.
Update on Oregon Health Insurance Exchange Corporation. Rocky King and Amy Fave.
Sure. While they're coming up, it might be useful around what Representative Freeman just asked to ask our alleged counsel to distribute to us the conditions under which the state can sponsor these sort of things. And there are a set of very specific conditions, so it might be useful if we could share.
Yeah, let's do that.
All righty.
Well, we have Rocky King.
Yeah. Nothing is showing, Kelly. Thanks.
Okay, please proceed.
Get this. Oh, this is not plugged in.
Yeah,
oh, got unplugged. One hand, second.
Yeah. You can go ahead though.
Well, she's doing that. Good morning, Chair Anderson, Co-Chair Greenlick, Co-Chair Thompson, who just stepped out. My name is Rocky King. I'm the interim director for the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange. And I'll have Amy introduce herself for a quick minute here.
My name's Amy Favre. I'm the interim deputy director for the exchange.
So about 90 days ago, when the governor appointed me as interim director, he gave me four tasks. The first one was to bring up the corporation, interim for 120 days, doesn't give you much time. The second was to really start the work on developing a business plan that we'll be bringing back to you for the February session. And the third was to continue putting the bricks together and building the exchange. The fourth was to start to think through how we're going to integrate the transformation of the delivery system into some of the exchange concepts as we begin to do that. I'm here today really to report on the first three. The fourth we're kind of putting behind us a little bit until we really get up and running. I'm going to give you the breadth of things that we've been doing for the last couple months, really 83 days. I'm not going to go into a lot of depth. We'll try to go through this rather fast. In November, we hope to come back and do a little bit more in-depth on some selected things when we've had a chance to do those. So with that, we'll go ahead and start off.
All right. As Rocky said, we haven't been up and running very long, and so we have here what we're calling our placeholder mission. As you all know, our board of directors, the Exchange Board of Directors, is up down the hall right now for confirmation in the Senate Rules Committee. It'll be voted on today, and we plan to have our first meeting next week. Once that board is seated and starting to discuss, they'll take the direction that you all set out in Senate Bill 99, the mission statement that I think was a page long, and really come up with a mission statement of their own based on that work that describes the essence of what the exchange is and what we're going to try and accomplish. As staff and during session, talked a lot about what sort of organization we want to be. And the slides that are clicking by are some of the words that we keep in mind as we move forward, thinking through who we want to be as an organization. We want to be transparent. We want to be accountable. We want to be innovative. And most of all, we want to be customer-centric. At the heart of everything we do, we have to keep in mind who our customers are. And our customers at the exchange are the individuals and small businesses who will be eligible to purchase insurance through the exchange, who will hopefully find a product there that they want to buy and will come and purchase insurance that works well for them and for their families. We also see as a customer the insurance companies, because at the end of the day, we need to have an exchange where the insurance companies want to sell plans. At the end of the day, we're not serving our primary customers, the consumers who will purchase insurance, well if they don't have a diversity of choices. So while we're certainly not looking to create an exchange that is exactly what the insurance companies want it to be, we are, as we build this exchange, keeping in mind who needs to want to participate in order for the exchange to be successful. We also have a variety of strategic partners that we will be working with, that we started working with now and will continue to work with for the next, ongoing, but particularly for the next year or two while we develop and build the exchange. We have the consumers, we have the insurance companies that we mentioned who are also strategic partners. We also have a variety of other stakeholder organizations, including the business associations that represent some of the employers that we want to serve, consumer advocacy groups, the legislature, our legislative partners, our legislative oversight committee, and the other state agencies that we're working closely with as we develop an exchange that serves all Oregonians, from 100% subsidy Oregonians who may be eligible for the Oregon Health Plan to those who might not receive any tax credit through the federal government but find the exchange to be a good place to buy insurance. As Rocky said, we are a startup. We've been up and running not even for 90 days. We've been up and running for about 80 so far. And in that time, we have been doing a lot of basic infrastructure work. We've hired our initial staff. We have 16 people on staff right now, and we'll talk in a minute about what some of that work is. We're drafting bylaws, personnel policies, et cetera. We're securing a lease on facilities so we have some office space to work out of. And we're getting our basic structures in place, our telephone system, our computer system, et cetera. We're planning out our strategic communications plan to be able to engage stakeholders, not only in the next few months as we develop the business plan for you all, but over the next several years as we create an exchange that works well, and some of our other contracting, procurement, payroll, accounting systems.
So as I said, we've hired 16 staff. We've brought together talent from both the public and private sectors. Some of us came from state agencies, the Oregon Health Authority, DHS, and the DCBS Insurance Division. We've also retained a number of private sector consultants to fill in some areas that we think we need help in. We've contracted with actuarial services. We've contracted with Diana Bianco, who many of you know from the transformation work, to help us work through our organizational development with the board once they're seated. We've also made a couple of key hires from the insurance industry to bring on some of the technical expertise that we need as we build these pools. As a startup, we know that what we need today in our staff is different than what it'll be in a year and what it'll be in 2 years. We don't really want to have a staff where we have fixed titles, fixed job duties. So we like to say we're operating out of circles of work instead of squares on an organizational chart. All of us consider our jobs and our titles interim because we know that in 6 months our jobs will look different as we move from a planning stage to a building stage to an implementation stage and then ultimately to an operational stage. We don't know how many staff we'll have at the exchange in a year. We have a lot of decisions that the board will help us make about what staff do we hire on as in-house and what staff do we contract out for. We know that somewhere along the road we're going to have a call service, a call center to serve folks who need help buying insurance through the exchange. Whether those are exchange employees or contracted out to another entity, we don't know yet. The circles of work that we have identified so far that we're primarily focusing on include external relations, staffing our new board of directors, reaching out to the key strategic stakeholders and customers that we need to involve as we build the exchange, and communications. We also have a planning, building, and implementation circle that is where the real nuts and bolts of building the individual and small business exchanges will happen. It's where the technical work is going on.
No. I'll keep up.
And Rocky, jump in here if you want to add anything. Okay. We have an information technology circle that right now not only is making sure we have computers and email addresses and a corporate website, but also is partnering very closely with DHS and OHA on the Early Innovator Grant to make sure that we build an IT system that works for all of the agencies involved so that we have a seamless process once we hit day one on January 1st, 2014. And we have an administration circle, which is our financial administration, our human resources, our contracting, and our facilities work. We've identified some areas that we still need to bring on board in the short term. We have a lot that we'll bring on, you know, probably down the road. But in the short term, we're looking for some more expertise in benefit design and plan management, communications and marketing, and the enrollment and billing processes that we'll have to build into our system. Rocky, do you want to walk them through the board?
This is the longest I've ever sat here without talking, so thank you, Rocky. That was pretty good. As you know, the board, the governor has nominated 7 members of the public, and then we have 2 ex officios for the board. They're down there at the confirmation hearings today. So I just want to go through who they are so you know, and at our, hopefully, if we're able to come back in November, that some of those board members will be here and be able to be a part of our presentation. But first, we have Ken Allen, who is the executive director for AFSCME. I got to tell you, he worked on the insurance pool governing board when we designed the FIOP program, and also as a part of the design of the small business programs that were very successful in the 90s. So he's familiar with a lot of the programs that we've put together. Terry Andrews, a small business owner in Corvallis, and is one of the few people that I've met who can explain to me the IRS tax credit for small businesses program better than the IRS can. She is an engineer, patent attorney, who also owns a small business manufacturing business. Liz Baxter, most of you know, one of the most pragmatic, giving, consumer-oriented people that I've met in my career, and she will be joining us on as representing consumers. We have Leah Christofferson, who's a small business owner in Bend, a small communications firm, has been very involved in all of the work groups that led up to the initial proposal for Senate Bill 99. We have Jose Gonzalez, Tucasa Real Estate Company here in small real estate firm here in Salem, and just brings a lot of compassion in and really knows how to work people to people. Again, some of these folks I've met for the first time and spent 3 or 4 hours with. Others I've known for a long time, but Jose is very impressive. Dr. George Brown, talk about being able to manage an organization, CEO of Legacy Health Systems. He has been very helpful to us in really looking at the role of the board and some of his ideas around that. Gretchen Peterson, who is with Hannah Anderson up in Pearl District. She's the HR finance person for Hannah Anderson for 20 years and representing kind of the larger business side as opposed to small business. And again, very knowledgeable about the purchasing role for businesses. And I think you know the others, Dr. Bruce Goldberg, who was here earlier, ex officio, and the other designee for DCBS could be the director or the designee, and Scott Harris chose to designate Teresa Miller, who will serve on the board. We've kind of already come out of the box, even though they're not named yet. We've got at least 4 meetings scheduled. Our first one will be next Friday in Portland at the Market Square building, Market Street and 5th, from 8 to 12. It will be really the coming out of the board, their first meeting. And we have 3 others scheduled, and another one in October, an all-day meeting retreat on November 1st, and again Monday November 22nd. We also have 2 additional board meetings that we've scheduled for December in the last couple of days. Their initial focus, so when they sit down at the table, will be really to implement the corporation, approve the bylaws, look at the ethics and conflict of interest forms, and make sure that we've got all of those in place. They'll have a work plan over the next 5 to 7 months that will lead, hopefully, to a successful and a business plan that we will be presenting to you in February. They'll be making decisions around board governance. They have to appoint an executive director. Remember that the governor's appointment of me lasts for 120 days. So beginning November 1st, they've got to make a decision who they want to go forward with that. And also the branding and communications. We don't have a name. So they need to come up with a name. What are they going to call ourselves? The Oregon Health Insurance Exchange.com? Well, that's already taken. So we've got to figure out what our name is going to be and really what are those words that we showed you that we want people to associate with that name. They've got to develop the mission and the vision and the principles, come up with the objectives and outcomes. One of my first questions to the board is, where do you want us to be in 2017? What do you want us to look like? As a staff, for us to do our work, we've got to know what they want. What's the picture that we've got to work to? We can't come up with that unless they really give us that direction. We'll have the draft business plan, presentation, discussion, and drill down over the next 2 or 3 months, and a lot of public input, including the individual consumer, the individual and small employer consumer advisory committee. So I'm going to let you take the business plan.
Sure.
Go.
As Rocky mentioned, the business plan will be the, probably one of, if not the primary focus of the board in the first few months that they're up and running, knowing that we need to present a business plan to you for the February legislative session. We expect to have a draft plan that staff has been working on to present to the board for their consideration at their November meeting, one of their November meetings, so that they can take public input on the plan, on the draft plan in November and December. And as you noticed, we have several November meetings, and we plan to have probably 2 December meetings to give them some time to really work through that. They'll get input from the general public, they'll get input from the individual and small business consumer advisory committee, and then also, of course, from the joint legislative oversight and advisory committee. Our goal is to have a plan that the board has approved to present to you at your January interim meeting of these committees. Knowing that the February session is only 35 days long, we'd like to give you a little bit more time to think about it, discuss it, and have a real dialogue prior to the February session. The plan, as we're envisioning it right now, and of course it's still very draft, is to have explanation of the mission, our governance process that the board selects, and they'll be discussing that with help from Diana Bianco facilitating conversations at their first couple of board meetings. A detailed section on the operations of the exchange, and this will be around the core areas of work. There's a lot we still won't know by February in terms of decisions made, but we'll be at least outlining in those sections our process for making some of those decisions. We'll have an overview of our communications plan. This is in the early years focused on outreach, as I said, and then later in marketing the exchange and the products that will be sold through the exchange. We'll have a detailed section on financials. I think this is the area that a lot of stakeholders will be interested in, and rightfully so. We want to be able to show what our projected enrollments are at year one, year two, year three, and what our projected revenues are, so that we can say with you know, the best degree of certainty this far out that we will be self-sustaining when we're supposed to be, which is January 1st of 2015. And then finally, we'll have a section on evaluation that will outline the metrics that we hope to use, we intend to use to evaluate whether we're successful in reaching our goals. The Individual and Small Employer Consumer Advisory Committee is a statutorily required committee, part of Senate Bill 99. It's a committee of the board. In order for this committee to really have a meaningful opportunity to put in, to provide input into the business plan, we've jumped the gun a little bit. We sent out a call for interest, a call for nominations to the public in early September. We wanted to have the pool of people interested in serving on that committee ready for the board, once they're confirmed, to make some decisions about the membership of that committee and the charter for that committee. How do they want that committee to help them at one of their early board meetings? So we've asked for the interest forms to be submitted to us by tomorrow. If you all, I've heard from several of you about folks that you think would be interested. If you still have people, please let us know as soon as possible. Because we'd like, I think the board is planning to, or our work plan shows that the board will make those decisions at their October 6th meeting. That gives the Consumer Advisory Committee time in October for us to bring them questions, key questions we want them to weigh in on as we're still putting together the draft business plan. Rather than just say, here's our draft business plan, what do you think? We'd like to involve them while it's still coming together and get input on important questions, so that then in November they'll see our draft business plan and be able to continue weighing in.
So we've got the corporation going, we've got kind of the planning and business plan, but now let me talk a little bit about some of the bricks we've been working on. The shop exchange and the individual market. Remember, shop is really the business, the small business portion of the exchange called Small Employer Health Insurance Option Program. That isn't our name, it's a name that the ACA gave it. We've actually already created technical work groups to identify some of the policy issues and develop some of the framework for considering how a shop exchange would work from Oregon's perspective. The exchange, or excuse me, the group is made up of representatives from the exchange staff. We have some industry experts from some of the insurance companies, some of the technical folks, some carrier representatives, and we also have a business representative for the initial technical group. We expect to expand that to include both employees and employers and agents as we kind of move out and develop that structure a little bit. After we finish with the shop, we'll kind of go into the individual market and just remind you there's really one exchange, but it has two components as far as the commercial side. We have the individual exchange and the shop exchange. So somebody comes in, you'll see a little buttons up there, employer, individual. And I want to go through, though, what we're looking at for the shop exchange, because we've got a lot of the associations that we've been working with that have been pretty excited about this. There are four options. Small business, you walk in the door. Very traditional option. I want to buy carrier X, plan X, and here's the dollars, and you have to contribute so much. You do that today when you call up a Blue Cross, a Health Net, a Kaiser, or whoever, and you say, this is the plan. The employer picks the plan. Option two, which is what we call plan bundling. And that's where you pick out, as a small employer, a carrier, and say, you have your choice with that carrier of one, two, three, or four plans, but they must be with that carrier.
So that's the second option we're trying to build into the exchange. That is starting to be offered out on the market today. It's called plan bundling. So some of the carriers actually offer that option to small businesses. The third option that we have asked this technical work group to figure out is what we call multiple carrier but one plan. Here's $500, employee, go pick which carrier you want, but it has to be this level of coverage. And or it's, we'll say $300. So if you pick a plan that's $340, come up with $40. If you pick the plan that's $300, I pay for it. It's a defined contribution. You come up with the difference, but you have your choice among those. The fourth option is the most challenging, and it is the one I spoke a couple weeks ago to the Oregon Truckers Association. All the truck owners, not the drivers, but the owners of the firms, said if I can get to this fourth option, they are going to be raising their hands. And the fourth option basically says, here's $300, here are the seven carriers, the five carriers, here are the four plans, you choose. It's up to you. This is truly the defined contribution. This is the one that the employer groups that we talk to and the small business folks say, you can get me out of the business, I can define the contribution, and I don't have to worry if somebody wants a very rich plan or wants Kaiser or wants an indemnity plan through Health Net. I just have to worry about what I as a business can afford to contribute. I got to tell you, there's a lot of technical challenges to this around how do you aggregate the premiums among all the carriers and make sure that the premiums flow with the risks. What do you do about risk adjustment? And we'll talk about that here in a minute. But the risk adjustment is probably going to be really key. You know, we've talked about this for a long time. The federal models, we're working with the carriers to say within this shop exchange to make it work, what do we have to do internally perhaps to have our own risk adjustment system. And Kevin McCartan, who is doing some of our actuarial support, is working with the carriers to try to come up a way so that it creates a level playing field so they want to play in that kind of defined contribution system. So we're really excited about that particular piece.
Senator Cruz?
Four I really like, and you know that. When you're talking about risk adjustment, and there are the federal models, do we run any risk by creating something different? Is that a waivable thing, or can we just do it? If we come up with a risk model that works better for us than what the feds have on the table.
Chair Anderson, co-chair, Thompson, co-chair, Representative Green Lake, Senator Cruz. my time is up.
You can leave me off
doing that. I will tell you that the risk adjustment and all the risk reinsurance, the risk adjustment, risk corridor that the federal government has kind of put out proposed rules is a subject for a good half-hour discussion here. I will tell you we are all on that. We're watching that. We're working with the insurance division. We have a governance committee. I think some people heard about it yesterday, made up of the insurance, OHA, exchange, and DHS, that is one of their top topics is to look at how we're going to work together among the four of us, actually three of us, to make sure that the federal models work and where they don't work, that we're prepared to come and propose to you state-specific models that we think would supplement that or replace those.
Okay. Follow up, Madam Chair. I guess, Rocky, my point is if indeed we look at what the feds have on the table and say, it ain't quite it. We come up with something that we think works better. Is that something we can just do, or does it require waivers?
Senator Cruz, we can propose similar models. We don't have to follow their model.
Okay.
As long as it does, it reaches the same objective, at least that their model does. Okay, so let's go with start real quick. January 1, 2014.
Representative, wait a minute.
Thank you.
Going back.
Well, I was just going to, on the plans where they come up and everything, and you've probably got into this or you may not have yet, but when someone purchases, say, a silver plan at $350,
all of a sudden, insurance company, how long do they have to hold at that price for $350? Is it like a one-year lock-in that you have it for, or can they raise the rate at any time? Because now I bought it at this rate, but then it's just like my car insurance or whatever. All of a sudden, they send me my next month invoice, or I do electronic payment, and it went up $30. Well, what'd you do that for? Right now, I got the ability. I just cancel it, and I go with somebody else. But I'm wondering how we're going to control that in the exchange.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Widener. The ratings will be controlled by what currently are state laws. And, for example, for employers, it's what's called plan year. So it's an annual price increase, and that's by state law in the group market. So the whole rating structure and what's allowed and not allowed that's applied to the general market will also apply to the exchange market as it relates to when rates can change, the rate reviews, approval process. All of that will still be a part of the general rate review process of the state. So the short answer to your question is, or the long answer, I guess, no, they're not going to be able to jump rates up every other month. They can't do that now. They're not going to be able to do that then. Okay, I want to go real quickly through some start dates. Legislation was passed, you know, in June of this year. Our board is being nominated. We've spent the last 83 days putting together the infrastructure, the staff. We'll have in February a business plan that comes before you for your approval. In June of next year, we really have to put forward our operating grant that will take us about for the first 2.5 years. So that's going to be the big dollar figure to really do the rollout. And first year of operation is, remember, that the federal government will provide all operational funds up through December 30th of 2014, so including not only the planning, the building, and implementation, but the first year of operations. We were in January of 2013. We'll need to get approval from HHS that our system's ready to go. And if we get the thumbs up from them, we're ready to move out. IT systems testing early spring of 2013. And as you know, it's kind of a modular system, configurable. It's like Legos, so we can actually test different parts of the system as we build them. We really don't have to wait and press a button and say, does it work? And we'll get into some more detail, I think, at a later meeting on that. We expect the system to be fully operational in June of 2013, which gives us time then to do that rollout, open enrollment in October of 13, first coverage January of 14, and sustainable from a financial standpoint in January of 2015. One of the people we brought on board was a retired CFO of a major insurance company, who I will tell you is putting us through the financial modeling that we need to really do to be able to make sure that each one of these pieces were within budget, under budget, and that in fact the projections that we've put forth, we can be sustainable. And we can, just like opening a restaurant, you have so much revenue and so much expansion, you better hope your revenue is greater than your expense, because if it's not, as far as the exchange is concerned, it closes down. And we'll have the plan that will be shown you as a part of the business plan, shows you kind of the range of high to low, what we kind of expect and what we think we can do in that. You want me to go?
Mm-hmm.
Key decision points. Obviously, the integration with Medicaid, what's going to happen with the essential benefits, all of the outreach strategies, whether we're going to, what kind of customer service and call center configuration we're going to have. We have a lot of regulations that the federal government has put out, and we are going through really a outreach process with our stakeholders to get input as we develop some of our responses to those regulations. We've asked for a variety of businesses, insurance, and advocacy groups to give us their input, and we've also reached out to OHA stakeholders to ask, based on what the feds have proposed, what's your thoughts? We hope to incorporate that into our response. So look at some of these regulations that we have out now. The exchange regulations, comments are due next week. Risk adjustment regulations, again next week. The eligibility recommendations on the proposed rules from HHS, due at the end of October, along with Medicaid eligibility. The tax credit regulations have come out, and they'll be due at the end of October. And we haven't got the regulations as it relates to the essential benefits package at this time. As you can see, the feds have really put it out there and asked all states and stakeholders to really respond, and it'll be interesting to see how long it takes to take those responses and actually get a final group of regulations. Just want to really show you, just real quickly, the key elements of a website. That this is not our website. These are the elements. There are prototypes being developed and worked on now. We're working with a national, there's a national study to look at user interface to base a lot of the designs on research rather than just what looks pretty to us. But we just wanted to kind of give you some ideas. So you've got the needs health insurance. You know, people need to put in their information, the general information. They need to put in information about their income, and based on that, they're going to get back, hey, you're eligible for a subsidy, you're not eligible for a subsidy, or seamlessly, it'll take you to the other options that you may have. Remember, you have group, CHIP, healthy kids, a variety of different options. If you are eligible and you get a subsidy, then you're going to be taken to a place where you start to rate what's important to you. Is provider access important? Is quality important to you? Is a lot of providers, a few providers? There's a variety of different standards that different work groups and will develop that we'll be able to put on there. Then you pick a plan. We'll be able to have prices. We'll grade those plans so people will know from our standards, meaning our, the exchange that they've developed, customer service, you know, AERS, all of that, they'll be able to make, hopefully, some sort of choice. Once they kind of give some prices, we lay out the different plans based on that. For the business, it's really a business coming on. Remember the four options. There will be a page at some point that says which of these four options you want to look at. But basically, the business enrolls, registers. Based on the information they give, they'll tell whether that business is eligible to come into the exchange. It has to have under 50 employees initially. After that, then it's really to enter the information around your employees, which creates an account for each one of your employees, who then go on and select the plans that they would like. So we're trying to make this as simple as possible, and as we put this together, we'll have sections on questions, so if consumers or navigators or agents, so that they can get information. Every person enrolled will be able to go look at their account, what they're enrolled in, if it's an individual, or if it's, say, an employee, or if it's a family. And again, the integration with Medicaid is the key thing. So we're not just talking about the commercial market. We're talking about healthy kids. We're talking about CHIP. We're talking about the Oregon Health Plan. So you'll be able to access through some one door. And then finally, there obviously will be, how do you get help and where do you go to get it? Now, these aren't all the elements. I mean, the example is, you know, when we've talked to a lot of people, they say, be sure and give me a button that just says, I want to browse. I don't want to sign up for anything. I just want to browse. You know, give me a button that says, I want to find out whether I'm eligible for other services. So there's a variety of those that that we will be really putting out there for the advisory groups to start helping us with.
Can we pick this up in November, Rocky? We're running really behind again.
That's the end.
We can roll it over and pick this up at our next...
I have one question. Navigators, or whatever we're going to call them, insurers. because this is going to be great for businesses. Businesses are going to be all over this. But for those individuals, and they've come to me and say, Lori, I need a plan that's less than $300 a month. I just was laid off on my job, and I'm not 65 yet. So the Navigators, will that be our brokers? I mean, or is that going to be part of what comes out of the meetings?
Chair Morris Anderson, I will tell you the outreach and how we connect and what our distribution system looks like for the individual market is going to be a tremendous challenge. And part of the task that we're giving both the individual and small employer in consumer advisory group will be to lay out for us all the different options and structures that we could consider in both our distribution system as well as our communication plan. I don't have the answers except to say everybody is going to play a role in trying to get these populations connected up with what's right for them. And that's including Navigators and agents.
All right. Thank you very much. Oh, Senator Bates.
Not a question for you, Howard. Just a statement. I haven't seen that before. We've been talking a lot about IT, and that's really the key to this program. There's great opportunities out there. It's so far going reasonably well. There are concerns, but it's going reasonably well. There also is a concern that the federal government's looking at Oregon as the lead state in this. They may ask us to do some things that would be broadening the IT program because they may want to take it nationally. And I want to prepare people for the idea that in October or November when we get back here, the federal government may be saying to us, we like what you're doing, we like where you're going, we want you to expand your program from $48 million to $100 million. And they've got the money to do it, and if we're going in the right direction, if things are looking good, that might be something that happened. I don't want people to get the impression that if that extra money is available and we expand the program, it's because we've done something wrong, is that we've been asked to do more. I want that out in front of the committee so no one gets shocked by that kind of a figure being dropped suddenly.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I will tell you other states are already contacting us. The federal government is already saying, hey, we like what you're doing. And it's kind of good news, bad news. The good news is we're kind of in the lead. The bad news is, what's that mean for other states? Because, I mean, we feel challenged. But I will, the term we use is cautiously optimistic that things are really coming together on the infrastructure side, on some of the ideas side that we're starting to put together. The board has to come here, but I believe you're right, Senator Bates. We will probably come back at some point and say they've asked us to do more than just what we're doing, and we need to get approval to get the resources, and they're willing to give the dollars to us for it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Next up, we have a presentation on genomics and public health. I'm going to ask Co-Chair Greenlick to introduce Dr. Fowler and his guests as they come up.
We read every day in the newspaper about these extraordinary kinds of genetic events that are going on in healthcare. I was reading the other day about a process for treating a rare cancer by taking 1 million T cells out of a person's body, genetically engineering them, putting them back in, and letting the new ones fight it out with the old ones. It is clear there are going to be some enormous genetic impacts on the healthcare system. Dr. Fowler and his students have been working very effectively to begin to look at the question of the public policy implications of some of the genomic issues that are happening, and I thought it would be very useful to have him here to help educate us on some of the issues. So, Greg, you're on. Please introduce yourself.
Good morning. Co-Chairman, Representatives Greenlick and Thompson, when he returns, and Chair Senator Mona Sanderson, happy to finally see you face to face, and members of the Joint Committee on Healthcare, thanks very much for inviting me and my grad students to be with you today to discuss genomics, P4, medicine, and the future of healthcare, a rather heady sort of subject. My name is Greg Fowler. and I'm an associate clinical professor in the Department of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at LHSU. During last spring, as Representative Greenlick just mentioned, I was the instructor of record for a new online course titled Genomics and Public Health Policy, which was added to the curriculum of the Oregon Masters of Public Health, OMPH, degree programs at OHSU, PSU, and OSU. The course teaching assistant and four of the eight first-time students to enroll in this course are prepared today to offer you an overview of some of the key elements which we believe will be pivotal to the translation of genomic discovery to the practice of P4 and genomic medicine. The photographs and short bios for each of the students are on the statements you've just received. And then the one-page informational document that was sent to you individually earlier in the week as well. We hope our efforts to inform you about some of the basics of genomics, which is defined as the study of not only the actions of single genes, but also the interactions of multiple genes with each other, and very importantly, with the environment. We hope that this kind of information is going to be helpful to your individual and collective committee work in healthcare transformation. By coming here today, we also want to share with you our collective sense and a kind of underlying premise, namely that we believe that healthcare reform in general cannot exclude the relevance of advances in P4, which is preventive, predictive, personalized, and participatory genomic medicine in its policy deliberations aimed at improving the quality of human life via biotechnology. Though the rate of accumulation of data is currently outstripping our knowledge of what to do with it, this will not remain the case for long, perhaps maybe 5-8 years at the outset. And we believe that failure to develop healthcare systems that are capable of dealing with genomic information now will do future generations a great disservice. Thanks again for this very unique opportunity to share the enthusiasm and excitement that all of us feel for what health-relevant discoveries lie ahead in this new and continuously evolving age of genomics. So now let's begin this briefing with the individual approximately 5-minute statements by the students, which are, by the way, arranged in order of presentation and which I believe you have before you presently.
Great, and if we could have a panel of three come up together, and then two, that would make it more efficient.
Great, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Powell.
Don't dawdle.
So, hi there, my name is Amy Boucher. I was the TA for this class this past term, and I'm actually an undergrad student at the School of Community Health at Portland State University. I'm going to be talking really briefly with you about preventive medicine and its applications in genetic testing. Genetic testing at the early stages of family development can aid in preventing life-threatening and debilitating diseases. There's several types of testing in early stages of life. We have newborn testing, which covers a series of different diseases. And in Oregon here, we cover about 30 diseases, although it varies from state to state what is being covered. There's prenatal testing, which is most commonly amniocentesis. But recently, actually, there's been a development where we can test maternal blood, and we can get testing results as early as 5 weeks into pregnancy. There's pre-implantation testing, where we test embryos before they're put into the uterus during in vitro fertilization. And there's also preconception testing. And that's kind of the area that I want to focus on today. Preconception testing is available for potential parents to find out if there's genetic conditions before conception. So there's actually a new test out provided to us by a company called Counsyl, based out of California. that can test for over 100 different genetically inherited conditions all at once with one saliva test. It is uncertain how couples who test positive as carriers might use this information to conceive a child without a lethal disease, since most of the diseases they test for have no cure. There are definitely options there, though. There is the pre-implantation genetic diagnosis that I talked about with in vitro fertilization. Parents can choose to have donor gametes and have donor sperm and egg cells. And there's also the option to prenatal test after conception. There's several issues to consider with this new testing. We need to decide if it should be a part of routine medical care, how people are going to be informed, and who's going to have access to this. So a key preventive measure is knowing that genetic testing is available before conception. Potential parents must be sufficiently educated about the emerging spectrum of genetic testing, not only to know what is available, but how gene-based technologies are becoming accessible to allow prospective parents to make informed decisions regarding family planning. There needs to be early, repetitive, and non-biased education. If it does become routine, healthcare providers need to know how to accurately interpret the results of these tests. There's access, the concern of our access of people is going to be also an issue. Although the test is relatively inexpensive, it's only about $700 per couple, that still can be a big chunk of money for people that are planning to have children. Fortunately, Counsyl, the company that's emerging with this test, is really aggressively persuading insurance companies to cover the costs. And they've already got a couple on board, and it seems likely with the cost benefits of this type of testing that they're going to get more and more on board. So in order to ensure that everyone is covered, the entire population needs to be insured, which needs to be addressed in the health reform discussions. Preconception is testing not only can prevent diseases, but it can enable parents to ready themselves for conditions that they can manage on their own. There's certain metabolic conditions that the test covers that you can really adjust dietary needs for. There's developmental conditions like Fragile X, where although these conditions pose health risks for people, they can live moderately fulfilling lives when they're affected. By being able to predict, not to mention prevent, genetic diseases in our children, health plans can be set in place that allow both effective and cost-effective management plans. I'm going to hand it over to Lynn. She's going to talk about predictive care.
Thank you.
So I'll cover predictive care, and there are, as the senior member of the class.
Please introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I am Lynn Ketch. And I am a constituent of Senator Thompson and Representative O'Shanahan, but I'm in the borderlands because I work and volunteer mostly in Senator Mona Sanderson's district. So my interest in this class is as a new member of the Oregon Public Health System, as a student at OHSU, is mostly as a volunteer and working with the vulnerable populations. So when I think of predictive medicine and genomics, there are three topics that come to mind for me, and that is access, safety, and privacy. Access is about the cost. I mean, these are all topics you're familiar with in healthcare reform, so this is how I see genomics fitting into that. Access is one of the cost, and the other is having access to physicians who are educated in genomics. And as long as you're meeting the needs of the vulnerable population, then you will most likely cover those who are affluent and can afford these tests on their own. Safety is an issue in predictive testing, and I like to talk a little bit about use two illustrations. One is the Alzheimer's gene, APOE, and the other is heart disease. It's known that if you just look at your family members, your parents and your grandparents, pretty much can predict whether you're going to have heart disease. It's not an expensive test. So in some ways, we can use genomics without even having to take a swab of the cheek. But what the question around safety is, and the example that they used with the Alzheimer's gene, is that the recent research they were doing with a collection of individuals up at OHSU is very revelatory to me, because I have family members who have Alzheimer's. And so it makes me wonder, what are my chances? And it turns out, when you've done some really good research, you find out that 1% of those who have Alzheimer's, actually, it's familial. So I've just... So the question just is, do I even need to spend the money on the test? And when we've got good research like that starting to show up. So in the issue of safety, I don't want to do the test because I don't want that information available to anybody outside myself who might use that information against me as an individual insurer. I have to pay for my own insurance. I don't want the insurance company to even have a whiff of it, because we've learned that even though you may have the Alzheimer's gene, you may not actually get Alzheimer's. And that's a new discovery, too, in the research that's being done. So the predictive nature is as tenuous at best, and I would prefer to keep that information private. It turns out that 71% of the population has concerns about who has access to their DNA information and what kind of vulnerability they will have if they put that into a biobank. So that then brings up what I call the third issue around predictive medicine, and that is privacy. Though we have HIPAA in place, when you start doing electronic records and you put my genetic information into the electronic records, HIPAA sure covers me in some areas, but what about security breaches? And then once somebody has a little bit of the information on my DNA with some computer savvy that far exceeds mine and statistical analysis, they will also be able then to develop or draw conclusions about me and my health that I may not ever have intended them to have. So those are the three topics that come to mind the most that I think are policy relevant in the area of predictive medicine. And then I'd like to hand off to Jenna for personalized care.
Hi, I'm Jenna Gribben. I'm a student at OHSU getting a master's in public health. So I'll be talking about personalized medicine. It's a vital and really inevitable segment of healthcare. The goal is to deliver an individualized treatment based on not only physical but emotional needs of the patient. Hopefully it will increase the effectiveness and safety of medical treatment to individuals. It's really based on a holistic approach, looks at the needs of patients and their families, physical and emotional needs, to really treat the patient and not just their symptoms. So there's a lot of advances that are needed to really implement this type of medicine, but there's a lot of progress that's been made. There's a lot going on. The cost of sequencing has gone down significantly. It continues to go down. We're within reach of the $1,000 genome, where for under $1,000 we'll be able to see everything about a human genome or a individual person's. Just recently, $5 million was given to OHSU to attempt to crack the code on melanoma. That's some really important research going on in Oregon. OHSU recently hired Dr. Joe Gray, who has worked on the Cancer Genome Atlas Project that's trying to map and catalog the cancer genome, all the mutations involved with it, so we can use that for cancer treatment. But there is a lot of work that still needs to be done in this area. There's a lot of both social and technical barriers that we have to get past. So, first off, importantly, is understanding the molecular aspects of disease, and that, you know, comes with looking at the diseases like cancer and things, and for scientists and physicians to really be able to understand that. We also need information systems, as was alluded to earlier, that they need to be not only developed but also regulated. We need to be able to look at millions of data points that we're discovering. As Greg mentioned, you know, right now our information is moving faster than we know what to do with, so we need to be able to handle that. We need to keep this information from profit-driven companies and from people that could use it to harm us, as Lynn was saying, but we need to
not, but in addition to that, we need to make it accessible to people who are doing the research and can advance this field. So that's a balance that we need to strike. And then additionally to these technical barriers, we also have a lot of social barriers that need to be addressed in the terms of personalized medicine. The general population, I think, views the level of healthcare, especially in America, as being relatively high, and they don't necessarily notice or see the inherent value in these advances and how important they're really going to be. So that's really important to show people. And so that involves education of patients, policymakers, future researchers, future healthcare providers, and even current healthcare providers. And we need to have policy to create access to these advances. We need to have everybody involved, and just as the last people were talking about with health insurance, we need to make sure that there is universal access to this, whether it's through insurance or universal health care. Policy needs to ensure that everybody has a stake in this as it moves forward, and we don't just widen the gap in healthcare. So to get to this truly personalized healthcare, we need to make sure that everybody has access to it and people are interested in their own personalized healthcare. And so that brings us to participatory, and that will be, can switch presenters.
Thank you very
much.
Thank you.
While the other two presenters are coming up, I'd like to just mention, if you didn't pick up on it, the health engagement model update will not be on today's schedule. That was issued on an earlier change of venue thing, but some of you may not have it. Also, the Regional Health Equity Coalition report will be last today. So next, we're going to be doing a presentation of insurance premium rate increases. So those two are coming, but in reverse order. So please continue.
Okay.
Don't use that term.
Good morning, Chair, co-chairs. My name is Tyler Johnson. I am also a member of the OMPH. I'm going for my MPH in international health at Oregon State. I'm here to talk to you about participatory medicine. In the last decade, there's evidence that healthcare consumers have become increasingly more proactive in managing their own healthcare, especially in the genetic health region. As a case in point is the growing number of online companies offering direct-to-consumer marketing of genetic testing, and these tests cover a broad spectrum of diseases. At the same time, these very same patients remain reluctant to go to doctor's offices and clinics to give their same participation towards medical research by collecting and analyzing genetic material. Part of this is because of reasons of privacy. It's critical that we gather this unique information because we are 99% similar on a genetic level, and so we need to gather the information that's the 1% that sets us apart so that we can make decisions and help patients make their own medical decisions based on this information, which will increase the safety and effectiveness of treatments. In order for this inclusion to take place, the societal mindset surrounding medical participation needs to change. Most of this change can come through education. This is especially true when talking about anything involving genetics or genomics, which is, both those terms are not understood by the public at large. Actually, genetics is just starting to be understood. Genomics, even in the healthcare arena, many of the healthcare workers themselves have no idea what genomics means. So finding willing participants will take education on both of these terms, and also terms of disparities and equities that may arise. We need to define those, and so that we can pinpoint those for when they do arise. Dr. Charles Rotimi, which is the current director of the Research on Genomics and Global Health at the National Institute of Health, believes that we should understand human genetic variation through genomics because of its global impact to ensure all human populations are engaged in the use of genomics to solve societal problems. And this concept of patient participation that's been growing in the medical community has been growing for decades. And it's not a huge leap to extend this from where it has been growing to the genomic level and as it applies to P4 medicine.
Some of the folks up here didn't hear the definition of genomics, so maybe you could help us.
Okay.
Just one more time.
Genomics is extending what we know about genetics to the whole genome, how genes interact and interact with their environment and stuff. So just kind of interaction between genes and the environment instead of just a genetic, you have this gene. For one person, for people to participate, they need to feel comfortable with giving their data. So they need to feel like if they allow their genomic data to be taken, that there needs to be privacy policy designed to guard this genetic information while at the same time allowing it to be shared to further medical research. And this will both benefit the donors and the users and the population at large. It is also important that models of deliberative democracy be the framework for the healthcare reform, and this be included in the healthcare reform. This is in particular reference to the genomic medicine. Such a model is described in the legislative briefing book that we passed out to you. Ultimately, these changes would significantly impact the relationship between doctors and their patients, as well as organizations which currently are in place to support the traditional interaction. There's already interactions afoot in Oregon. A couple days ago, Portland Interhospital Physicians Association gave out grants to be used for clinical innovations, notably in the areas of patient engagement, patient safety, and transition of care. Oregon is clearly on the right path, and what better way to continue down this road than by making the patient an active participant and an equal valued member in a healthcare team occupying a homeroom genetic model. Corey?
Good morning. My name is Corey Morse. I am a practicing clinical social worker in Portland as well as a student in the nurse midwife program at OHSU. So I'm going to try and tie this together a little bit and bring it into the practical realm. The medical home is kind of the materialization of P4 medicine that we've been talking about this morning. The ideal medical practice, medical home practice, includes a space where patients feel that they're part of their care and that they feel well taken care of. So to give you a really concrete example, I work in internal medicine at OHSU on the HIV team. The team's made up of 3 HIV physicians, a psychiatrist, a pharmacist, myself as a counselor, a case manager, an RN, a medical assistant, a front desk person. It's a really comprehensive team. And together, we work with patients individually to make sure that their needs are met medically and psychosocially. To bring genomics into it, we aren't yet
every day incorporating the human genome into our practice, but dealing with HIV, physicians do run genome tests on the virus and then analyze those results, looking at mutations that tell us what medications the virus might be resistant to. So the physicians and the pharmacists work together to develop a medication regimen that'll work best for that patient for suppressing their virus. A really important part of that kind of testing and that kind of information is the patient education that goes along with it, because an informed patient is more likely to adhere to their medication regimen, stay healthier, decrease healthcare costs for themselves, and improve their quality of life. So having this team model really enables us to be able to do that, because there are so many players involved in one patient's healthcare that the physician can do their part, and there are other people to kind of support both the physician and the patients. So the ideals of the medical home model are already in line with the aims of the Oregon Health Policy Board and the Oregon Health Authority, and the additions of genomics and P4 medicine that we've been talking about this morning has the potential to really improve lives and quality of lives for Oregon citizens. So our hope is that going forward that's something that can be thought about and included in legislation. Thank you.
Great. Can you join us for a moment in case you have any questions? I really do have a question. I mean, the thought that we can all get our whole genome sequenced for $1,000.
Oh, that's pretty amazing. Sure.
Yeah, and but the question, what are the implications of that? I mean, we talk about data systems, and now Dr. Bates has in front of him the human genome of each of
his... I'm just checking yours out right now.
it's a weird
not a
one.
Picture.
Well, we're 99% similar. That 1% makes a big difference.
Yeah. $5 yeah. for some tips.
Great. What do you perceive as the... I mean, that's quite an extraordinary thought.
Well, that's right. I mean, in fact, there is a project known as the Personal Genome Project, which is handled out of Harvard University, and there are about 10 people worldwide who have had their entire genome sequenced. And one of the huge issues that comes from that kind of information is, of course, the issue of privacy. That is, what will happen to that kind of information? And these people, in fact, right from the outset, have chosen to go the public route. That is, they don't mind. They have given permission that all of their information about themselves, their warts, their wrinkles, their additional earwax, whatever kinds of things are uncovered by this kind of information, which I must say is more trivial now at the present time than it will be as we understand what all this really means relative to genes and disease states. But they've given permission that all of this will be available, and it is indeed available online, and anyone can look. So I think that the implications primarily revolve, at least in the public sector, around the issue of privacy and what's going to happen to this information. How is it going to be collected? How is it going to be managed and stored, shared, and protected? And so I think that's one of the key issues in all of the new genomics. Is really what happens to this information. And also, for most of us, it is, well, how meaningful is this information going to be? We're really much in the early stages of making the connection between wellness, disease, and genetics. But it is inalterably a road, a journey that we're on, and it is not going to go away. Biotechnology is only going to make these kinds of technologies more accessible rather than less. So what do we as a community, patients, future, present patients, how are we going to benefit from all of this? And I think another issue that Tyler brought up, of course, was the equity issue. Who has access to it? This is at the present time, a kind of boutique science. So who gets it? People with money, right? Please. That's kind of important.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question would be, what direction and where do you see this going? Because when I was listening to the prenatal and some of that, yeah. I mean, I could see this becoming a society where all of a sudden you go through a stage where everybody wants blonde-haired, blue-eyed children, or they want this type of child.
Well, now I think C is doing bad things, but I can see the positive when we're taking it to fight diseases such as cancer or anything like that. But to make the decision about what type of child you're going to have, or, okay, honey, you got this disease, so I'm just going to go get semen from this guy over here, and then find, oh, my egg's bad, so now I got to get an egg from this lady over here to have my child. To me,
all those things.
Those are
all those things will happen. Yes, that's right. And I think it's not something that just because it will happen that shouldn't lead us into having a more engaged and robust discussion about these kinds of possibilities. All that will be possible, and in fact, it's already being used. And that's why we have so many political issues, religious, political, ethical, social issues that revolve around this new technology. How are we going to unpack it? And as Amy was pointing out in her introduction, this new predictive test, which can be done non-invasively with parents who are just thinking about conceiving, they want to know, is there something in our background, in our family, in our genes, if you will, that would cause great pain and suffering for our offspring and for us, and we'd like to have that tested, and that now is available. And it's highly controversial because of exactly the issues that you bring up. How, what will happen, just as it, as we know is happening, patients who are having this non-invasive test are deciding to do use the technology known as pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, whereby they fertilize eggs in vitro, in petri dishes, and then with gene probes they look at these very early stages of embryos and are looking for particular genes, and they in most cases have a genetic problem in their family of some kind. So they're looking for probes that will tell them that this particular embryo in that petri dish has that gene or not. And then at that point they're really looking for that unaffected embryo to then implant right in the uterus, and that's what they do. So what do they do with the others? They freeze them, right? Generally, because we just can't come. We're still in the midst, right at the heart of that discussion of what is a human being, when does sentient life begin, and so on. But the fact that those issues are there should not allow us to simply disregard where technology is taking us, and what are we as a society going to do about that. Is it something that matters to us? The kinds of human suffering that these conditions will produce. Do we eliminate them? How do we do them? And in many cases, when you have these non-invasive kinds of technologies like that, determining already at birth what the child is, before birth, right? Before it's even been conceived, what you want is fantastic. It's incredible. It's great power and also frightening in many ways.
I may follow up.
Yes,
so, sure. Because with that, I mean, we could create a lot of like-minded people, which to me, it's our differences that make us great. But I guess whoever has the most money, I guess we could wipe off all the Democrats from this committee up to two or Republicans.
Or decide who we want.
You guys have more money. There's no question about that.
There are savings.
Did you just vote for that?
Sorry.
How does this work?
No, but you know, really, we can try to put a humorous side to it, and I think, but yet it's the importance of these technologies and the fact that they will only be more available to us means that any kind of healthcare reform transformation simply must include these technologies and the ramifications that they have for any kind of health care that's going to be accessible broadly and effective as well. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Lou.
Hi there. How are you?
Fine.
Good to see you. I am concerned, and you have heard this from me before, but I am concerned about how well the general public understands this, how well the students are being taught it, where they're getting the information, if they're getting the information, both in school as well as in media.
Sure.
Can you give us a sense from your classes and from the programs that you've dealt with, how well that this is in fact taking place? Who knows, who doesn't?
Well, I think that those parties have been already identified in the course of these five presentations. That is, the general public certainly is not aware, except largely in the negative, for the reasons that we mentioned of transgressions of privacy and so on. The healthcare professionals are a huge arena where education is critically important in this area, and it's that's a very tough nut to crack, if you will. It's very difficult because the work is not being broached and discussed broadly in medical schools as well. So it's awfully difficult to take practicing physicians and tempt them with the idea that they need to go back to school, basically, and learn a whole new arena of medical care based on these genomic discoveries. So I think in all of these areas, education is going to be and is indeed a challenge. One of the things that Tyler brought up was, of course, a model for deliberative democracy, which I personally have been working on for a number of years, and that is outlined in the legislative briefing book, Chapter 7, that the students put together at the end of their course. The reason I bring that up is that this whole issue of education comes, I think, with regard to policymakers, with regard to medical professionals, practitioners, and most particularly with the public, is because they have indeed a great stake in the kinds of policies that are going to be ultimately made, that in the process of having that stake and being involved upstream in the policy process, not reactively, but upstream, when the policy person stands at the podium and says to a group of the public gathered in a room, such as we're doing, have been doing for a number of years with the Oregon Health Decisions Project, what kind of policy should we put together? And here we could say about genomic medicine, for example. Their input right at the beginning would require that they have a stake in it and that they educate themselves about what that is in order to be able to say something important to a policymaker. I think physicians are no different from this. They also need to take the lead in how they're going to really apply genomic medicine to the benefit of their patients. And as Mitch pointed out, with the genome sequencing, now it was, what was it, 10 years ago, it was $250,000 to have a sequence of your entire genome. In 5 years, at the max, it's going to be $1,000, and much of that will be covered by insurance. So when all of us go to our physician, waggling this heap of paper that is 3 billion bases or chemical bases that make up our DNA, all of it containing about 25,000 genes that make us human, we're going to take that to our physician and say, what does this mean? Tell me, it says I'm going to have XYZ, I'm predisposed to these conditions. What are you going to do about it? And furthermore, the variation that there's this word here called single nucleotide polymorphisms. That's how it's all put together. You know, that's how these are the variations, genes that are inherited together. But this is what Tyler was talking about. We're 99% sort of similar, but 1% different. And it's these single nucleotide changes, these changes in the chemical bases that make us very unique. And even identical twins are different. That's another issue. That's the environmental influence. So if we're saying, so what does that mean, this single nucleotide polymorphism? So that to the physician. Well, just a moment. Let me dial up someone who I think can get that answer. In other words, and not to mention that there's no time that physicians have really to spend the hours, the days indeed, to interpret that kind of information to a patient. We have huge issues in that arena to address. So it is going to change the relationship between physicians and their patients tremendously.
Senator Shields. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going to the issue of privacy and consent, it made me think of our next topic, which will be regional equity efforts. And my spouse has turned me on to a very good book that you all might be interested in reading if you haven't read it already, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. And I thought I'd just take a moment to recognize her and the pain and suffering that she and her...
That's the Henrietta Lacks, right?
Yes.
That's, right. That's an excellent
to get
book.
Here. And and so this is a woman who donated, without her consent, very hardy cancer cells that have laid the groundwork for a lot of these advances. Yet, even today, her family still is struggling with being able to get basic health care. And it's, I think, particularly at a research hospital like OHSU, it's very important that we understand that history of our inability to live up to privacy and consent and to do better in the future. And I also just want to take a moment to honor her memory.
Thank you for that. It's a sad case.
Yes, Senator Bates.
A couple points and possibly a question. I'm a practicing physician.
Yes, I know.
Okay, and I would tell you that physicians, as a general rule, are vitally interested in this and absolutely intrigued by it. And we go to our CME classes, that's one of the things we talk about the most. What's the latest? What's the latest as far as genes are concerned? What does it mean in practical use? And the thing we run up against the most, I think for most of us, is that the people who have information about their genetic mutation or the gene issues, especially for specific diseases, Huntington's, cystic fibrosis, don't want to act on it. We continue to have kids. We ask them and talk to them about the options and what that child might be like if you decide to go ahead and have children, and they go ahead and have children. Science is far ahead of the moral issues and the social issues here, and the general public, I think physicians for the most part are there, but the general public is not there at all. And as you discover more and more things, I mean, we have a family history which points us in the direction clinically where to go. This will be part of the family history now, a much more specific part of the family history. When you talk about prostate cancer, we have a gene now we're watching for that. We have two genes we're watching for breast cancer. Mm-hmm. There's going to be more. The melanoma gene we think is out there. We can put that into our practice. We can't get our patients to act on it.
Because we
are so far behind socially and morally in this thing. You started to touch on the social issues here. And what my question is, when you go out and talk to people, not at OHSU, because you're looking at a very fine strata of people there who are referred to OHSU, who are very interested in taking part in this. When you talk to the general public about a mutation or a gene they carry in their family that could be life-threatening or really affect their life of the child, they don't want to hear it. And they don't act on it.
Lou Thomas used to talk about half technologies, and in a sense, being able to have this marvelous gene that tells you if you're likely to have Huntington, if you will have Huntington.
No, it's not likely. You will have
it. You
will have it, absolutely.
That's
and
like
they
the
don't
era,
want to know.
But that's like the era of the iron lung. In polio, I mean, you remember what that was like. I mean, essentially, the science will get there when it's able to change your gene, so
that's
you
right.
won't get it.
But we can't
that's
do
what
that.
Science
yet.
Will
right,
catch up with
right
us.
Right now, we can tell people your child will, if you choose to have children, your child will have Huntington's, and if don't you know what
half
Huntington's disease is? It's a combination. I think the worst Parkinson case, the worst dementia case, hitting you at age 40, and you talk to 17, 18-year-old with this disease, and they say, I don't want to know. I got a 50-50 chance of having it. I don't want to know. So what's been your reaction to talking to those people?
Well, Corey, you want to say something?
I think
that's a good point.
That really emphasizes the importance of the medical home, the patient-centered model of having these patients having a relationship with their providers. As a physician, how much time do you have to spend with your patients on an average visit? My physicians get 25 minutes. That's not enough time to cover any of this. So having those other support people available, I'm a counselor who's in the clinic. When people come in to see their doctors, they can meet with me. I have strong relationships with a lot of our patients so that when they don't understand something that the doctor said or it's too overwhelming for them to deal with in that 25 minutes, they have other resources available. And in HIV, I talk with a lot of my patients about having children and what their options are and how safe that is and what the choices available are to them. So it's having those other support people around and making the time for the education.
Well, thank you very much. We need to move on. It's a very interesting topic. And
well, let me just say that the materials that we've given you, I think, will be very helpful as resource material. And I can unequivocally offer the services of all of us to meet with you individually at your pleasure and talk about any of the issues that are particularly important to you, and we'd be happy to make ourselves available to do that.
Thank you so much
for inviting.
And thank you, students, for coming. With that, we'd like to move on to the presentation on insurance premium rate increases, and that is Lou Savage.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chairs. How much time do we have? I want to make sure that...
It'd be nice if you can consolidate it to 15 to 20 minutes.
Oh, absolutely.
And then we can leave 15 minutes also for the regional health equity.
I can definitely do that. Good morning. My name is Lou Savage. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And with me today is Barry Leslie, who is the Deputy Administrator for the Insurance Division. I'm pinch-hitting for Teresa Miller, who is had a longstanding commitment to the Kaiser Foundation for a presentation on rate review. So I'm just pinch hitting for her today, and I will be brief. We're here today just to give you an update on our health insurance rate review process and talk just a minute about the grant which we were awarded this week by the federal government, $4 million. The Ways and Means Subcommittee has recommended approval to the full Ways and Means Committee. So ultimately, the Ways and Means Committee will decide whether we're going to be able to spend the money. And the nugget for the grant is really the rate review hearing process that we have begun. And I think most of you know that in June we held a hearing on a Regents request for rate hike. It was in the amount of 22.1%. So we took this opportunity to hold a public hearing. And the results were very, very positive. The plan itself, the request for a rate increase impacted 59,000 Oregonians. So it was the largest, single largest individual health plan policy in the state. So we took the opportunity to hold a public hearing. And again, it was very, very successful. We had about 150 people attend in Portland. The hearing was structured so that we gave people an overview of our health insurance rate review process. We had Regents give a presentation to justify the request for the increase. Our division staff questioned the company about its request. Nonprofit Osberg gave comments about the request, and then we had time for public testimony. So the process itself was very positive. We learned a lot, and it really improved our ability to analyze the request. Ultimately, we reduced the request from 22.1% to 12.8%. There were a number of factors in that, the feedback that we received from the public was very positive. We recognize that rate review is just one piece of the healthcare puzzle, that in fact medical costs are really the primary driver for health insurance rates. And in fact, one of the benefits that we see for hearings is that it allows the company itself to tell its story, you know, why rates are increasing. The success in that hearing really guided us in our proposal to the federal government for a second round of grant funding. And we really want to extend a thank you to Senator Shields and Representative McClain for all the input they gave us in formulating this grant proposal. So the plan, again, assuming that we get the go-ahead from the full Ways and Means Committee, is to hold hearings on virtually every request for a rate increase that we get from health insurers. Typically, we get about 50 a year, and for that reason, the cost, which is going to be funded by the grant, is significant. So the grant will pay for those hearings, the staff that we need to have that frequency, and the comments that we're going to be getting from the public interest entity, the nonprofit. We're actually going to be sending out an RFP to get proposals for that designation, the entity that we'll be contracting with.
Mr. Sarris, do you, when you have the insurance companies come and they testify, okay, our medical costs have come up, are they required at all to take a look at, okay, their increases were a lot in diabetes or a lot in hypertension or heart disease, and then look they're the insurance, they just pay the bill, and I would hope that they would have information that could be shared to try to look at how to, for providers, to be able to cut the costs for the health delivery. And somehow that I wish there was a nexus.
Chair Mona Sanderson, both Regents, and I should mention we had a hearing last week with ODS, both companies did a really pretty good job in laying out what the cost drivers were, and even in particular areas. And now that nexus that you're talking about is a little bit tougher. I mean, when we review the request, we make sure that they justify those increases. But that nexus, I think, is something that needs to be explored. We've got some fairly specific guidance from the statute as to what we can look at. And frankly, in terms of how far behind those costs we look, that's a challenge.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to really give a pat on the back to the division for taking some good, really good first steps in this process. Representative McClain and I met with the insurance division at least twice during the course of the session and after to make sure that the grant proposal, which was going to be significant, really brought this process out in the open, because we felt that this was too important to small business to have happen behind closed doors. And Representative McClain and I really took a fine-tooth comb to what the insurance division was proposing. We suggested that they put a significantly more dollars into contracting for a second opinion from an outside group. And again, I think the next challenge, and Representative McLean and I will be meeting with the current contractor on Friday to discuss this. The next challenge is going to be to really make sure that that consumer group represents small business, and that small business really has some control over the project and has a seat at that table. So I think, you know, the first couple of hearings were good first steps in where we need to go. I also passed out to the committee some testimony from one of the people who presented at the Regents hearing, Larry Kirsch, who has some ideas of where we might go next. And I wanted to make sure that that was part of the record. And so again, I think you're on the right track. We'll be keeping an eye on it, and Representative McLean is very interested in it, and making sure that small business has a seat at that table.
Yes, Senator. Yes, Representative.
Can I ask briefly a question? And Kirsch's testimony on the second page, he points out, or he asserts, that there isn't enough detail in the documents on the website to allow independent analysis. Have you had a chance to think about that, and in terms of what gets put on the website?
Chairman Sanderson, co-chairs, Representative Greenlick, we have quite a bit of information on the website now. And in fact, we are now posting the discussions between the two our actuaries in the division and the company's actuaries. So I'd be interested, and I haven't seen, I know that that's part of this testimony. I haven't seen it specifically. So we certainly would want to take a look at that to see what he thinks ought to be on that's not on. We think it's, we basically are posting everything now, all communication, all the comments by the public, all the comments by the not-for-profit. So I'd be interested, and we certainly can get back to you on
that. Senator Shields will share his memo with you.
Yeah, yeah, and it was part of the Regents' testimony. I will say that's part of the reason why the insurance division is saying we're going to have this kind of public meeting so that the public can ask questions, because that's the key part. I mean, even if you have 500 pages of documents, there are a lot of assumptions that go into the projections, and you need to know what the underlying data is. And I think that's why it's so important that you are moving in the direction of having those public meetings, public hearings.
And
I was just going to say, I appreciate that. We part of the grant is going to go to improve the technology, and we're hoping to be able to have folks observe the hearing and participate without even having to come to the site. So, you know, that's going to be part of the improvement. And we've had a tremendous number of folks go to the site and make comments, just in terms of the number of folks who visited the site. It's almost 12,000 folks since May, so it's a pretty good response.
Thank you. You made just a little bit of a comment that caught my attention and concerns me, and the chair asked the question, what's the underlying driving these costs, what's the real root cause of this? And you said that's a bit of a challenge, and that's concerning to me. I think in many ways the insurance companies are our messengers. They get the bills, they pay the bills, they set their premiums. They could probably do more to drive those costs down. I'm not sure what the profitability is. I'm going to get to that, because that's your process to go through. But underlying all this is something significant. They asked for a 20% increase in premium versus something. And I know physician fees aren't going up 20%, certainly not in my office. Pharmaceuticals are actually going down. DME is pretty stable. The only thing I see going up in a large context is hospital costs are just going through the roof. And you got to get back to those root things and have a discussion about. So my question is, one, what's your challenge in finding information out? Why isn't that part of the process? And number two, will the all claims, all payer database be available to you, and will it help you?
I think the answer to the second question is yes, it will. The answer to the first question, I would actually want to consult with our actuaries about how deep into the information we get on those. I mean, they certainly set out what those costs are. You know, going behind those costs and questioning, you know, what the contract says, with a particular provider and how they come up with that figure. I'd have to get back to you, Dr. Bates, on whether we get to that kind of granular.
Just to follow up real quick, that's information you really need to have. I know it's difficult, it's hard, but that's what you really need to know. You never solve this problem without it.
All right. Any other further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm sure we'll be hearing from you in the future. And now for our final item on the agenda, regional health equity, Tricia Tillman.
How can I use the PowerPoint, or should I just go from
the staff will help.
I have copies here too.
I don't expect it again. Shelley, can you just go on the S drive?
It's right here. It just.
Oh, we're ready to go.
So do you all have this on your laptops, or you're going off on the screen up here? Good morning, Chairs Mona Sanderson, co-chairs Thompson and Greenlick, and all the committee members. I'm Tricia Tillman, and I'm the administrator for the Office of Multicultural Health and Services in the Oregon Health Authority, and I appreciate the opportunity to present to you about the challenge of promoting health equity in Oregon. We strongly believe that tackling this issue head-on is in the best interest of the state, not only in the promotion of health of all Oregonians, but also in order to contribute to the economic vitality and competitiveness of our state. And you've heard today about health systems and health insurance and health at the cellular level, and all of these factors are impacted by health inequities, and I also want to kind of broaden the discussion to talk about impacts at the societal level. So what I'm hoping to cover in the conversation today is to share about how we define health equity, how the social determinants of health and equity are woven together in both the current and historical context, and then to share how our office and our community partners are promoting health equity, particularly highlighting the regional health equity councils. So if we think about optimal health and well-being as the top of an escalator, we can imagine numerous aspects of our lives that have made it either easier or harder for us to move up to the top. And those things include how easy or hard it was for us to get a good education, have a good career or a job, be able to own and keep a house, how much access we have to a healthy environment, whether that includes parks, access, or living in a safe neighborhood, in addition to clean air and water, how much access we have to fruits and vegetables, as well as the time to prepare healthy meals, or how much access we have to places to exercise, as well as time to do so. And these are some of the factors that contribute to people feeling like they're either riding up that escalator, sprinting up that escalator, or trying to just run up the down escalator. But some people might feel like they can't even get on the escalator to good health, or that the escalator to health and well-being doesn't fit them, no matter how hard they try. And I think it's through this metaphor that we begin to understand where we fit on our journey to good health, and also start to understand the issue of health inequities. So the factors I just mentioned, like employment, housing, education, access to healthy food, and an active lifestyle, those are known as the social determinants of health. And they are represented here on the left of the slide as a focus of population-based public health approaches. But encouraging healthy individual responsibility and treating the consequences of less access to health is also important. It's also part of our work in terms of addressing health inequities, and that's shown as fitting within the medical model. And research has shown that access to health care accounts for only 10% of health outcomes. And most of health comes from how individuals interact with their environment, both in terms of their choices, but also in terms of the range of choices that they have available to them. So the Department of Health and Human Services defines health inequities as adversely affecting groups of people who have systematically experienced greater social or economic obstacles to health. Since the birth of our country, there have been populations that have been intentionally advantaged and those that have been intentionally disadvantaged. And the fact that this dynamic of advantage impacts our health has been known for generations. However, health inequities are not inevitable. They're avoidable, unfair, and unjust. So I wanted to share a couple of examples of past policies that have contributed to health inequities in Oregon. And based on the social determinants of health, you can see kind of how they fit. So the Oregon Constitution, adopted in 1857, had provisions that prevented people of color from entering the state and prohibiting those who were already here from holding real estate or doing business in the state of Oregon. So economic impacts that affect health. And the termination of Western Oregon Indian tribes in 1954 abolished tribal governments, ended federal services, sold off tribal lands to non-Indians, and simultaneously disrupted tribal members' family stability, economy, education, and health. And even though these policies happened some time ago, they and others have created kind of a head start for some and disadvantages for others that have been sustained for generations. And these policies, I think, reflect some kind of social norms that are also reflected within healthcare and that have limited access to healthcare as well as quality of care for all. Inequities in economic opportunity persist today. In 2008, a study showed that Black and Latino borrowers in Oregon were twice as likely to get a subprime loan as whites of the same income level. And the consequences of these predatory loans are now experienced by many Oregonians across the state, but are particularly impacting the African American community. Inequities, as you know, show up in current healthcare challenges as well. For example, while all population groups in Oregon have lower access to prenatal care than the national average, almost one-third of Latinas and American Indian women have late or no prenatal care. And we know that this translates into healthcare costs in terms of neonatal intensive care and other costs. And increased
later no means after the first trimester.
Yes. Well, or no prenatal care, right. Increasingly, research is showing how chronic stress, including in early childhood and throughout the life cycle, like brought on by social factors such as housing instability or unemployment impacts health not only in the severity of disease, but also in the earlier onset of the same condition. So these are some things that we're hoping to impact around health systems transformation. So we can understand many disparities that exist by focusing on particular population groups or by disease, geography, or risk factor, and many times they overlap in many ways. But the bottom line is that health disparities cost us in human capital, in premature death and disability, and in loss to families, communities, and the state as a whole. And health disparities cost us in real dollars. The cost of health inequities on a national scale over only a four-year period is staggering. This number represents the combined direct and indirect cost of health inequities and premature death in the United States. And eliminating health disparities for people of color nationally over the same time period would have reduced direct medical care expenditures by about $230 billion for this four-year period. So moving into solution space, the National Partnership for Action to End Health Disparities, which is, of course, a national effort headed by the Department of Health and Human Services, defines health equity as the attainment of the highest level of health for all people. And we'll know that we've achieved this when we can no longer predict life expectancy by race, income, or zip code, which we can identify life expectancy by those measures. But to achieve health equity requires ongoing efforts to address current and past social injustices from both the healthcare level but also broader societal factors, such as unequal distribution of resource and opportunity. One of those efforts is represented by the American Medical Association, their Ethical Force program, which focuses on patient-centered communication. And one of their strategies looks at employing and training a workforce that reflects and appreciates the diversity of the patient population, a workforce that can build trust and convey information that's understandable and empowering, a workforce that's trained to determine language assistance and make that available where it's needed. It's just one of the many strategies that they've identified through this program. So just briefly, can take a look at what the Office of Multicultural Health and Services has been working on. We have been focused on promoting health equity through workforce development, both broad within the healthcare workforce, but also within the Oregon Health Authority, building community capacity to address the determinants of health and understanding baseline data. And that is referred to in our State of Equity report, which is on our website. Our goals for the upcoming biennium are similarly focused on workforce, community, and we're spending a lot of time, like all of you, on health systems transformation. So we want to highlight our regional health equity coalitions, and I'll be passing the mic shortly, through our partnership with the Public Health Division and the Northwest Health Foundation. We funded three coalitions, one in Jefferson County, one in Linn and Benton counties, and a coalition that includes Clackamas, Washington, Multnomah, and Marion counties. These coalitions are currently in their first year, which focuses on organizing, planning, capacity building efforts. And in the second and third years, we'll fund two non-competitive continuation grants to implement their plans. And then the third year, we'll also incorporate implementation and evaluation to see how effective those coalitions are at building capacity at the local level to address health inequalities. So with the remainder of my time, I'm going to turn it over to my colleagues from Benton County Health Department, who are part of the leadership team for the Lynn-Benton Health Equity Coalition. And in the time remaining, they'll provide some specific background on their regional health equity coalitions. And then we can take questions after that. Yeah. Let me pull up there. Go ahead.
I think we can talk about this later. We have to do it here today. But one of the things I would like to see out of this is as we move toward these community-based healthcare plans, CCOs, transformation, what's the role of this and where's the seat at the table? Because we're talking about all kinds of doctors, all kinds of healthcare providers, parish nurses, all these things coming in and sitting around a giant round table and discussing a community's healthcare needs and future. I don't see this in that plan, although there's room for it. And I think we need to have a very quick discussion, you know, beyond this meeting on how do we put that in the governor's plan. That is a consideration at the local level.
I'll follow up with you. I'd love to have that conversation.
It's a rubber hits the road kind of situation. We can talk all day about the needs and various evaluations and all of that, but we're right now doing this against an enormous budget deficit, and if we start leaving things out, they're going to be left out for a long time.
Right. And so. Yeah, I appreciate your comment, and I'm happy to follow up with
we'll
you on that.
Yeah, we'll talk about it.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Karen Levy-Keon. And
I'm Rocio Munoz.
And we appreciate you having us here. I see that some people are needing to leave, and we have a very brief presentation, so we'll move on with it. As Tricia mentioned, they funded three regional equity coalitions, and we represent the Benton-Lynn Health Equity Alliance. And we're a group of a diverse alliance across our community who really believe that that we have this common interest in creating a community where everyone has healthy places to live, work, learn, pray, and play. The group has been together for 3 years, and in those past 3 years, we've been able to spark conversations and forge partnerships. We've created meaningful programs and policy changes that Rocio will touch on. But what we're really excited about is with this increased funding that we've received from the state, we have great plans for the next 3 years. We're hoping to be able to strengthen and expand our coalition. One of the biggest changes is that we've been focused in Benton County, and people have heard about the work that we're doing and really have wanted to be involved. And now we're going to be able to expand to Lynn County, which is our neighboring county, and hopefully even into counties beyond that. We're able to support and mobilize vulnerable communities to engage the people most affected by health inequities. We're able to have a place at the table in talking about healthcare transformation, and we'll be able to identify and implement policy, system, and environmental changes. So really changes at a lot of different levels. And in fact, when we look at the groups that comprise our coalition, we're really functioning at all the levels. Here in the bottom, we've got individual level groups, but all the way up to kind of the policy and systems change. And what we've learned in the work that we've done so far is that it really takes people working at multiple levels to affect the kind of change that Tricia talked about, where you're really impacting health at that broader level.
And a couple of our examples of our efforts.
Can I introduce yourself, please?
Oh, sorry. Rocio Munoz again with Benton County Health Department. So some of the examples that we've been working on in our community, and I just really want to highlight one or two of our efforts, is the 100% Lincoln campaign. It's a school-based campaign that grew out of our families and parents that were really wanting to make sure that the whole student body of that school was 100% insured, that they have insurance and had access also to the benefits of their health insurance. So with the use of community health workers and or health navigators, we didn't just create access for children to have health care, but also made sure that they were connected with people and made appointments and actually used the services and benefits of the campaign. Another really great example is the Campeones de Salud, or Champions for Health, soccer tournament and family weekend, which is much more than a soccer tournament. It's really a lot about health, and it's making sure that with the use of community health workers and health navigators, we go out to the community and give our community access to health benefits such as immunizations and health screenings, dental services for the very first time, people that have never used or had dental services in their lives. So these are just some of the efforts that we've been really trying to focus on as we go through and be part of the Health Equity Alliance. So if you have any questions, we are more open to that now. These are some of the pictures of our events that we've had throughout the past years, really highlighting the access to physical activity. And Escuelita de Futbol, a youth soccer program that is really targeting people that are, vulnerable communities that have not had access to recreational programming or different types of health services. So it's really going to them and really breaking down barriers of families that may have such as transportation and other social determinants of health, and really addressing that and breaking down those barriers.
I think it's really important to build community, because that's how you can then educate the community. But we still need to make sure that we can have a nexus between what you're doing or what these activities are doing and health outcomes, because we are going to need to have proof that what we're doing is making a difference in health outcomes, because we don't have a whole lot of money to invest in our health.
Right. And I think one of the things that we're looking at, just to follow up also on Representative Thompson's comment, is we're working at a staff level to make sure that, for example, community health workers or patient navigators or peer wellness specialists can be reimbursed through Medicaid, so kind of that administrative side. But what the regional health equity coalitions are doing is making sure that their communities are ready to engage in those conversations with CCOs as they develop, to make sure that as we're asking CCOs to think about community-wide health outcomes, that they've got community folks prepared to say what the health needs are, what are the strategies that work regionally, and make sure that there's a representation of diversity of voices in those CCO conversations. And that's, I think Lynn and Benton County are further along. Jefferson County has been doing a lot of work around diversity dialogues, and they're switching, kind of moving into kind of diversity as it relates to healthcare, and thinking about how do they integrate with conversations in Central Oregon, and then similar efforts happening within the metro area in Marion County.
Thank you, Patricia. I wanted to add to that comment in response to your question about going to the people. I think part of it is going to them and providing services, but in bridging those gaps, it enables people to see how that they can participate in the political process and to be able to give them tools to do that. And that's some of the projects that OCE has been working on, such as OLU.
Yes, we have the Voceros de Salud project, which is a lay health ambassador or supporting emerging community leaders to be part and take action or have impact on policy and environmental change. So it's really just building capacity around their efforts and what they are, and having a voice. Because for a long time, when we started some of these projects, people really were hesitant. Will I really be heard? And it's just really creating a comfortable space for people, building trust at the same time, and that way they can take action in their own hands and be able to talk about what their neighborhoods and what their community is really going through and being part of and have a space at the table.
So hopefully you'll be seeing people from our communities, involved in the healthcare transformation and here talking to you.
Wonderful. Any other comments? Well,
thank you very much.
Ms. Administrator, do we have anything else that we need to address?
Not.
Our next committee meeting is, I think, going to be, thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Appreciate it. Yeah.
November 17th.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Just a comment not related to this panel. So,
thank you.
And this is somewhat anecdotal at this point in time, and we know how rumors fly in this building. But most of us will remember during the last legislative session the battle over the hospital tax and there was a lot of blood in the water, and there were several issues. One was reimbursement rates, the other was par non par, and they are clearly tied together. And we did reach an agreement that the bills passed virtually unanimously in this building and were signed by the governor. And so we had an agreement on reimbursement rates, and now we are hearing the potential that the governor may be wanting to change that formula. And I find that, Madam Chair, troubling 3 months after he signed the bill that he's wanting to relook at this thing on a couple levels. One, kind of a deal's a deal, but number two, potentially the usurpation of legislative authority. And so...
Would you mind, Mr. Minister, just having the governor's office send us an update on his thinking on that, and maybe we could have a conversation in November?
Madam Chair, that was my thought. And if indeed there is merit, I think it's something that should be brought before us for consideration, not done unilaterally by the executive branch.
Thank you. Any other comments? Well, with that, I'm going to adjourn
the Senate.
Interim committee.
I will adjourn the House Interim Committee.
Okay.